Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
And all your success, it's well deserved. I know how hard you guys work on stage and off, and it is a joy to hear new music from you guys. Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Striker.
You got it. There you go. They are the Offspring, Rise and Fall, Rage and Grace. Thank you very much for listening to this hour. Go get the record. It is out. And thank you for listening to the Offspring Radio Network. Goodbye, everybody.
With a microphone, with a microphone, with a microphone.
Oh, yeah?
And I can split the atoms of a molecule, of a molecule, of a molecule.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to the broadcast. Let me see here. There you go. That's how you turn that baby down. Jalene Jordan is with me as usual. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter. Don't be drowning us out now. We have a lot of important things to say tonight.
Yeah. Should we start with the more trivial ones?
Sure.
Yeah. We had a good time last night, didn't we?
We really did.
Thanks for coming by our house. I really appreciate it.
You know how to throw a party, Peter Werby.
A 50th anniversary party.
Yeah.
But not for me and my wife.
Right.
But for the peace sign. You know that everybody knows what the peace sign is, right?
Well, except for one certain store.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, that was so bizarre. So here's the deal. You know that peace, everybody knows what the peace sign is, right? I can't even explain
peace
it.
Peace man.
Peace man. You know, that round thing with this, it's a semaphore signal, and it's a C and an I can't even remember what it
was. Everybody knows what the peace sign is.
I think it's an N and a D. That's it, nuclear disarmament.
Oh, right.
And 50 years ago, in England, there were these big marches against the proliferation of atomic weapons, and in this case, the ones in England. So they had somebody put together a little sign for it, and he figured it out, you know, nuclear disarmament. And, you know, the right wing often says that it's the sign of the devil.
Do they really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I've never heard that. Do they really? That's just so not surprising.
Yeah, but that makes me like it all the more.
Okay, me too.
Yeah. But, they've had signs lately that said backed by popular demand.
Oh, yeah.
So here's the deal. So a friend of mine puts together has a whole little mini business selling peace sign stuff.
Which is cool. You know, and hopefully it's the people who really are thinking about the actual meaning of peace. Because, you know, like, for example, I was downtown today, big festival going on, and the peace sign has really grown in popularity. I mean, so many people are wearing it. You can buy it. You know, say you go to Target, they have T-shirts with peace sign. It's popular. It's like the flag after 9/11.
I wonder if that worries me somewhat,
though. It worries. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. I don't want it to become just saturated as a pop culture item, like the skull and crossbones are really hot right now. So,
is it?
Yeah, big time.
Well, you can go to peacebuttons.info. Peacebuttons.info, or you go to my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com, and go down the left side of it, where else, and you'll come to a little bumper sticker, and it says, let's see here, where is it here? Okay, yeah, it says, bring our troops home. It's a bumper sticker, and it says, peace and social justice paraphernalia.
Okay.
I should have had a smaller word. What is about stuff?
Stuff? Oh,
yeah,
stuff works.
Paraphernalia stuff. I think that's the same. Oh, yeah, we didn't even give the number. If you want to give us a call, talk on the air like we're doing, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And for the bashful, and when the lines are filled, call talkyes at yahoo.com. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. So anyway, we have this party at my house, and how many people do you think of it? 30, 40, something
like
that? Oh, yeah,
it was quite the crowd.
Yeah, in other words, I had to sometimes, if I wanted to get to one side of the living room, I had to go out kind of the back door and come in the front door.
I wondered what you were doing.
Oh, there he must be going out, too.
I had no idea.
Never mind. But in any event, so my wife said, well, let's get a cake and we'll get the peace sign on it.
Yeah.
I said, that's a great idea. So she said, do you think I should bring them
an example?
And I said, no, everybody knows what the peace sign looks like. So do you realize what it looked like, what they did?
Like the Mercedes sign.
Yeah. So
missed it because there's three.
Yeah.
At the bottom, you know, there's the two on the side and the one that goes from top to the bottom.
Right.
And they missed that bottom, portion. So it was
kind of the other, kind of had a different message.
It was the total opposite.
The cake was good. Actually, I thought the cake sucked.
Did it really?
Yeah, it was just one of those gooey, sweet, white, bleh. So we had a good time, and plus we got little party favors, which were the peace pins, and they're on a little cardboard backing that gives the history of the peace symbol.
Yeah, the information.
Yeah. In fact, I'm not wearing mine. Let me see. You're not wearing
yours. I didn't pick one up.
Oh, my God.
I missed the party favors. I saw them there. I thought you were selling them.
Oh, God. Oh, my God. Well, as many of you who are regular listeners know, that Jillian and I often go to anti-war demonstrations and other kinds of activities to promote peace and social justice as a way of direct action. Voting, it's okay, but it's not the most powerful thing people can do. If you think about history, how history's been made in this country and around the world, it's rarely about voting. Sometimes, right? And I think it's going to be very significant to get these incompetent criminals out. That's a mistake. Incompetent, it's got to be like incompetent and criminals, because they are, in terms of their criminality, they've been very competent.
True.
Okay. But there's going to be these big protests at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's turning up there. The Ron Paul people, all the anarchists are, we were talking about that last week. But also, people are going to be protesting at the Democratic National Convention in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah, who's protesting that?
I don't know. I mean,
I was wondering what groups. I mean, we could even protest it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm certainly extraordinarily critical of Barack Obama for being too far to the right.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's an improvement, but what you got?
Anything would be an improvement. But, you know, when someone said, wait a minute, did he actually say Barack Obama's too far to the right? Just give you an idea of where
we stand.
If I was going to say we, yeah.
I was amazed walking around and, you know, going out to a lot of events, as I do as part of my job, is all the Barack Obama T-shirts.
Really?
Unbelievable, Peter. I've never seen anything like it in any election.
He's got tens of millions of dollars. They're talking about him possibly taking all 50 states.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, I mean, to begin with, it's got to overcome racism and stuff like that. So I'm still a little nervous, you know.
Oh, sure. But I think he can do it.
Okay. This from the Rocky Mountain News, Denver stocks up on pepper weapon. And so if we're thinking about going out there, let me just say this.
Oh, yeah, pepper spray.
Yeah, but no, it's not a spray. Wait,
this is a new one. I saw this, but I didn't read the whole way through it.
So the idea would be to try to convince Barack Obama and the Democratic Party that they ought to have a platform and carry out programs and policies that are farther to the left than the centrist one that they have going now. I don't think they're going to be successful, but whatever. City orders guns that fire special plastic balls. Denver police are stocking up on guns that fire pepper spray-like substance instead of bullets, a less lethal weapon used to disperse crowds. Well, that's nice. I'm glad they're not going to be shooting the demonstrators.
Yeah, spray is painful stuff.
Yeah, it is. The department recently ordered 88 Mark IV launchers and projectiles at a cost in the low six figures. The company that makes the weapons stated in a news release Monday. The convention is August 25th to the 28th at the Pepsi Center.
I knew you were going to cringe.
Oh, man. Expected to draw thousands of protesters to sites throughout Denver. You know, I tend to doubt it. I mean, the Republicans are like the big enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there'll probably be a couple thousand. Now, get this. The city.
So it's a good thing they spent six figures on pepper spray.
But on the other hand, the city has received $50 million in federal grant money for security. And the city plans to spend up to half that amount on equipment. $25 million because a bunch of people in shorts and flip-flops are going to be out there saying, Barack Obama, do this or that.
Right.
Some organizers of protest groups believe police are buying extended-range tasers and weapons that incapacitate people with a high-intensity sound. Now, this is really horrible stuff because, for one thing, the more sophisticated the cop equipment gets, the more there is the tendency to use it.
Let's play.
Yeah, I've frequently quoted Napoleon, who said the only thing you cannot do with bayonets is to sit on them. In other words, if you have them, you use them. The guys that volunteer to use the tasers, you got to believe.
On tasers?
Yeah. Don't tase me, bro.
Don't tase.
You know, that was the top T-shirt, the top slogan, I guess it was, of 2007. Don't tase me, bro.
Oh my gosh.
So if we go to Denver, we've got to get some "Don't tase me, bro" T-shirts.
I would most certainly wear one.
Yeah, you know, it's got like "bro" at the end. That's what they'll aim for.
Right? Right, the target, right?
Yeah, right. The Mark IV weapons the city ordered recently fire plastic balls filled with powder that's, quote, like a combination of canned pepper and baby powder. Well, the last I don't mind.
What?
The balls open on impact. While the powder will incapacitate a person like pepper spray, it doesn't cause some of the more severe reactions.
It's something that actually hits you.
But the really bad thing is this. Where was this one deal that they were talking about getting? Oh, yeah, the weapons that incapacitate people with high-intensity sound. Everywhere where there's been, like, confrontations, mass demonstrations where there's been confrontations with the police, usually 90% of it is peaceful. But the police in those situations don't differentiate at all.
Yeah.
So what if you have 20 people wanting to go toe-to-toe with the cops, and they bring in this sound unit that incapacitates everybody, makes them throw up and everything?
Unreal.
Yeah.
You know, the last...
That's where our tax dollars are going, too.
Yeah, people. One of the last marches that I went to in Washington, and it was last year, it was a march on the Pentagon. Remember, that's what they called it?
Sure.
They wouldn't let anyone, of course, near the Pentagon, but there were all these old ladies who marched one way, and then they wanted to catch the metro to get back to where they were. And they had to go near the Pentagon to get it. And the cops were relentless, would not let these poor old ladies go. And these women were not making it back, going back this way.
Wow.
And so people were pleading with the cops. This is the kind of stuff that sets the cops off. Little old ladies marches.
The raging grannies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
that's who it was.
Grannies. Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, one of the reasons that things went on with the intensity that they did between Hillary and Obama was that the media had a vested interest in keeping this at a high pitch level because people watched, right? So now, I didn't even print this whole thing out. I don't know if I sent this to you or not. Michelle Obama shows her warmer side on The View.
I watched it.
I could puke.
Oh, it was pretty nauseating.
What do you call it? What's that right-wing
Elizabeth
bitch
Hassel
from hell?
Bitch.
Yeah.
I mean, Hasselbeck.
He touched her.
Oh, they did the whole knuckle thing.
Yeah, what is that? I was just reading.
Well, that's the new high five, So you go like this, and you bump knuckles.
And so
the reason Michelle Obama is doing it is because when her husband got the nomination or whatever, the nod or whatever, she gave him the bump.
Well, what it says, some moron, on Fox News anchor called it a terrorist fist jab.
Oh, yeah. Now the right-wingers are accusing Elizabeth of being soft on Obama.
This stuff is so sick.
It's kind of entertaining, though, you have to admit.
Well, it is entertaining, but it does affect people. And it's such a diversion. Who cares about Michelle Obama? Or who cares? What's McCain's wife's
name? Cindy.
Cindy. Who cares about her? I mean, why are they even... a subject for of interest.
Yeah, I mean,
she's going to be the first lady,
right?
Well,
so
who cares?
So what?
Yeah, yeah.
so she's going to pick out the dishes. You know, the china. She's going to pick out the china. She may have herself a little platform of her own.
Isn't this just another reason to turn it off, to not watch television?
Yeah, I couldn't look away, I have to admit.
I haven't done this in a long time.
Here, wait.
We like that.
It has been a long time.
Yeah.
That felt good.
Here is this is our old book. You're looking at me kind of strangely.
Billy Bragg.
This is our old friend Billy Bragg, yeah, from England. Billy Bragg.
Voices on the radio. Says we're gonna go to war. Brave men and women in their uniform wanna know what they're fighting for. The generals wanna see the end game. Now allies wanna prove the plan.
Thank you, Billy Bragg, a great entertainer and singer-songwriter from England. You can go to billybragg.com.
Yeah, check him out.
B-R-A-G-G, billybragg.com. And, I mean, how many years have we been arguing about the cause of the war, the reasons behind it? I mean, so the weapons of mass destruction, all that stuff is gone. But here it all is. I mean, most of us knew this, at least those of us on the left, those of us in the peace movement. We weren't fooled by Bush. But Article June 19th, deals with Iraq are set to bring oil giants back. Well, and this could even be the last time we ever even have to talk about this. Four Western oil companies are in the final stages of negotiations this month on contracts that will return them to Iraq 36 years after losing their oil concession to nationalization as Saddam Hussein rose to power.
Yeah, ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, that is it. And guess who leads them all?
Right.
ExxonMobil.
Yes,
yeah.
The most evil of them all.
And the one that is looting
BP
us.
Well, BP is horrible.
Yeah, and Shell, and Total.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Is it Total?
Well, it's French. You know, like
it is French, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, like the prime minister is... Sarkozy, or is it the president? He's the president.
Sarkozy, yeah.
But Bush calls him Sarkozy.
Prime minister?
I'm losing it now. Is he the president or the prime minister?
I think he's the president. I think you were right.
Yeah.
So where's Citgo and these four? Oh, that's right. It's Venezuelan oil.
Yeah. Okay. The original, in fact, they were the original partners in the Iraq Petroleum Company, which along with Chevron and a number of smaller oil companies, are in talks with Iraq's oil ministry for no-bid contracts.
They're just giving them.
Yeah.
Nice.
Well, they're going to operate them. I mean, that's what happens in a lot of other countries, these big international oil producers. They're the ones that pump it, and then they pay. Like in Venezuela, most of these same companies, except ExxonMobil, pulled out. But the other companies in Venezuela, when Chavez says, look, we want a little bit more money for the oil that you're taking out of our country, they said, yeah, okay, cool. The no-bid contracts are unusual for the industry. There was a suspicion among many in the Arab world and among parts of the American public that the United States had gone to war in Iraq precisely to secure the oil wealth these contracts seek to exact. That's such an odd way of writing, isn't it?
There was suspicion among many.
The Bush administration said the war was necessary to combat terrorism. That was about number 9 when they got down. It's not clear what role the United States played in awarding the contracts.
I think, how about this, the main role.
Yeah. There are still American advisors to Iraq's oil ministry.
Mm-mm-mm.
But let me see if there. I think there's more here. Oh, yeah. Well, so the other thing. Citgo, oil is $3.99. So,
I saw it for $3.98 on 8 Mile.
Wow. Wow. But as most of you know by now, Bush has urged Congress earlier this week to end a federal ban on offshore drilling. What out of control liberal put that in? Oh, yeah, it was his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot. He wants to open a portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil exploration, asserting that these steps and others would lower gasoline prices and, quote, strengthen our national security. Well, as I always say, you know, you can tell Bush is lying when his mouth is open. Mm-hmm. And this is just another enormous lie, and I guess everyone has pretty much called him on it, that that even if all of this went into operation immediately, and they began drilling all this and getting us more oil and refining it into gasoline, which is all problematic in and of itself. They don't have refinery capacity and all this stuff. That it wouldn't even come about till 2030.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also, in that same article in the New York Times, says the only real beneficiaries will be the oil companies that are trying to lock up every last acre of public land before their friends in power exit the political stage. That would be,
and that's the key thing. The oil companies now are sitting on all of this federal land for which they have lease concessions that they could be exploring and drilling. But let me ask you this, dear friends. Why in the world would they want to do this? They're making a fortune. In other words, it's supply and demand. I mean, a lot of it has to do with speculation. I forgot what percentage of the, they figure, of these oil prices are just this, you know, crapshoot called the stock market that's going on, oil futures and all that. But they're perfectly happy with things as they are because they're making hundreds of billions of dollars off of our misery. There's also not enough ships to send this all around. And again, why would they want to do it? Demand is so high that shipbuilders, most of who are in Asia, have raised their prices since last year by as much as $100 million a vessel to about $500 million. So why would the oil companies want to pump more oil and transport more oil? They're making the most extraordinary profit because of their gouging, their looting of us and other people around the world. So, yeah, forget it. This is all just a way, as the New York Times editorial that Jalene read, a way to give more public land. Get that public land? You know who owns that public land? Right. To their buddies in the oil world. Let me see. Is there anything more in this?
Just when you thought it couldn't get any worse.
Yeah. James Paul, executive director of the Global Policy Forum, says it's been a long road, but the oil companies seem set to get much of what they've been seeking. The Iraqi public is overwhelmingly opposed to this privatization of Iraqi oil. That's real important. Under Saddam Hussein, all these foreign companies that had previously, because Iraq was a British colony, and Britain 70, 80 years ago fought the same kind of battle that the United States is fighting now. In fact, they're back. The English are in there as well. The Brits are in there as well. So when Saddam Hussein, like so many other nationalist, radical nationalists in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, they said, hey, guess what? We're not allowing this oil, our natural resource, the wealth to flow out of the country, if you don't mind. We're going to use it for our own country.
It just doesn't seem so radical to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, now they've got it back. And let's see. Just like they are, the Iraqi people are overwhelmingly opposed to the so-called security pact with the U.S. What's interesting is that the New York Times noted the historic sweep of Western oil companies in Iraq. They are the very same companies that controlled all of Iraq's oil 80 years ago. So that's that.
They're back.
Yeah. Yeah. What was that from? Oh, Poltergeist.
Right.
Right. They're back. Yeah. There was another. If you needed any proof that John McCain is totally insane and absolutely, what's the word?
Well, he's just kind of evil.
Yeah. Well, it can't be president.
Money hungry, oil hungry.
He's called for 45 new nuclear reactors by 2030.
I couldn't believe this.
Yeah.
When I read it, yeah. I thought, wow, he's really going for it, isn't he?
Yeah. So
for the jugular.
They say that they've got this little litany here. I didn't underline it, but it said it's
as difficult as it is necessary.
Here. That McCain sees nuclear power as a clean, safe alternative. Safe. What are they going to do with the waste?
Who's he been talking to,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, I think he's talking to the hand or something like that.
I think so, too.
Carl Grossman, who is pretty incredible, he's a prof, State University of New York at Old Westbury. He says, he just wrote a piece called The $500 Billion for don't see where. Oh, yeah. Anyway, I don't see where he wrote it for. But anyway, he says, with Wall Street unwilling to finance new nuclear plants. So they know a bad investment when they see it. So the investors are absolutely unwilling to put up money for these nuclear plants that are just these disasters. So where is the money going to come from? Hey, it's from you.
Yeah.
It's from me. Right. Because what U.S. Senators Joseph Lieberman and John Warner of Virginia, they've cooked up a scheme to provide $544 billion in subsidies for new nuclear power plant development. So much for the free market, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is so you and I are going to be financing. Now, on one hand, I don't think that's so bad to have public financing to get us out of the addiction of oil that Bush, although he's the one that used that phrase, wants to maintain this addiction because he's an oil man and all his buddies are oil men. And they're the ones that have benefited, pardon me, along with the war industries from his presidency. We've all been screwed and the economy's been screwed. But if you look at their profit and loss statements, they're doing just really swell. So, the Lieberman-Warner scheme is, says Professor Grossman, is cloaked in a climate change bill. I think that went down, but you know, look for it to be resurrected like a zombie. The claim being that nuclear power plants don't emit greenhouse gases and thus don't contribute to global warming. Well, they don't. However,
they're extremely expensive.
Yes, the overall nuclear cycle, which includes mining, milling, fuel enrichment, and fabrication and reprocessing, has significant greenhouse gas emissions that do contribute to global warming. Okay.
Well, they're just kind of dangerous.
Yeah, and there's absolutely nowhere to put the waste.
Right, exactly.
So right now, all this waste that's being produced at, say, Fermi 2, Fermi 1, remember we almost lost Detroit, is sitting outside the plant, and
yeah.
We have nowhere to put it.
They've been trying to. Did they ever make it to Yucca Mountain Was it Nevada?
Yucca Mountain, Nevada. Everyone out there is opposed to it, the Republicans and the Democrats.
Boy, they really tried to get it.
They want to transport this highly radioactive waste from all these plants that
across the United States.
Yeah. Yeah. And then put it in these repositories. You remember that at most, now I think they put it back further, that human beings like us, Cro-Magnon or, you know, Homo sapien developed about 50,000 years ago. This stuff has to be kept for, 250,000 years.
Jeez.
I mean, this might be the final card that turns over. What is it in tarot cards when it's, is there like a death card or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, but I don't even want to go there. That's too creepy to think
it's
of.
It's pretty grim.
All right, Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, we're at 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
We have some open lines for you. Let's take a call or two before we go to our bottom of the hour break. Here's Trent in Auburn Hills. Trent, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
We're doing great.
Good. Hey, I have kind of a question and a comment at the same time.
Boy, that ought to be a trick, but go ahead.
Well, we'll work on this. Barack Obama, I'm telling you, I want to vote for him. I like everything he says and everything he's talking about, but I'm concerned that he has zero experience. Well, I don't want to say zero, but he does have a lot of experience. And he sounds fantastic. And put up head-to-head with John McCain, he talks a heck of a game. And John McCain isn't the best talker in the world, but I want to hear your opinion on what do you think these guys are. I mean, John McCain, obviously, he's had 40 years' experience in the House and everything. Barack Obama's a newcomer.
John Kennedy.
You know what? I've heard that a lot, but...
Yeah. Well,
John F. Kennedy's come around?
Well, I don't know. What I'm getting at is the experience thing. Is that, the example might be, look what happened when we got Bush in, right? That's part of the argument. Somebody that was so inexperienced but also you got to remember, Bush was so dumb and so unwilling to really, that's not entirely true. He was surrounded by people that had a lot of policy experience, including Dick Cheney. So in the same manner, Barack Obama would certainly bring in long-term experienced advisors, and they're talking about a number of people that would be his vice president, somebody like Sam Nunn of Georgia, who for years was head of the Senate for Armed Services Committee. And so I'll tell you that I don't have a single worry about that. What I do have a worry about is an experienced person like John McCain, who would be an experienced person like Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
So it's really ultimately about policy, not about experience. You know, I guess I'm keep saying the same thing. If you do have people that have the capacity to make good decisions and a good part of it based on experience, like anybody who's going to be in government, as a long term, has been in there for a long time, I don't think there's any worry. I mean, what we really got to look at is what kind of overall policy. And when John McCain, no matter how many times he tried to back away from it, says he doesn't care if troops are in Iraq in 100 years. What the hell does that say for any experience?
No, and I understand what you're saying. But I'm just wondering when you get the reins to the most powerful country on the planet, it's I wonder if things change. And like I said, I really, really, really want to vote for him, but I just get a little concerned. I'm wondering when it comes down to the deadline and I get in the booth, I might backpedal a little bit. And
well,
I need to reassure me.
Get ready. Yeah. I can't assure you. Get ready for 100 years of war, I guess. With McSame. It's I don't call him John McSame for just to be like an insult. It essentially is a whole political critique. That is to say, the election of John McCain will continue all policies of the Bush administration. He might be a little,
a little worse.
No, I'm probably not worse. Nobody could be any worse unless they, actually started a war with Iran and, blew everything up.
Let me ask you this, and this is what I'm do you think they're just completely running the fear factor? Because McCain's big thing is, if you don't elect another Republican, McCain's like, if you don't elect me, the terrorism, blah, blah, blah. The fear factor thing is so intimidating to so many people in this country.
Well, I agree. And I guess if I was concerned about security, I would certainly not vote for another Republican. Given that the most catastrophic security incident in American history, September 11, 2001, came under a Republican administration that had been warned repeatedly that they had to start paying attention to al-Qaeda, that al-Qaeda was prepared to strike inside the United States, that they were told that there could be possible hijacking, and they did absolutely nothing. So security concerned, we've seen in Iraq, Afghanistan, we've seen what these belligerent, incompetent militarists have done. I can't imagine what could be any worse. All right, we'll be right back. Thank you very much for being our first caller. We got a lot more people on the line, although we have one open line for you. 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan, we'll be right back.
I want you all to know.
Greatest country in the world.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
So I went out to lunch with those two hot chicks from accounting last week.
Oh, dude, I'm so jealous.
And we started talking about what attracts the opposite sex.
Oh, yeah, big, shiny car.
Hello? The one thing they both agreed on was a great smile.
Really?
Apparently, having healthy-looking teeth sends them a message that you take care of yourself. And if you care about yourself, then you'll care about her.
Yeah, but I always get nervous when I have to go to the dentist.
Yeah, I used to as well. Then one of the girls recommended Cherry Hill Dental Center. It's a state-of-the-art office that handles everything, including cosmetic and restorative procedures.
So maybe I should make an appointment.
Maybe. Come on.
What?
Dude, look in the mirror. When was the last time you've been to a dentist?
That's harsh.
Plus, they've got same-day scheduling most of the time. Just call Cherry Hill Dental Center. They're on Cherry Hill Road in Garden City. How easy is that? Or go to their website at cherryhilldental.com.
So, a good smile is going to help me with the ladies?
It can't hurt.
Hi, this is Dr. Dan. Backed by popular demand, Cherry Hill Dental Center's Zoom Summer Whitening Special. Just $2.99 now through Labor Day. Call 734-427-2880 or visit cherryhilldental.com.
We should all take the time to slip into something sexy, like the showroom at Demmer Lincoln Mercury, where you can run your fingers along the silky surface of a brand new beautiful body, the Lincoln MKS, some of them literally glimmering in sunshine because of the microscopic particles of glass in their paint. You might want to nestle into their soft leather seats and not get out, but for the true test, take it for a drive. And even though you missed the Demmer Lincoln Mercury grand opening, you haven't missed a shot at the savings on MKS sister car, the Mercury Milan. For AZ plan members, a 39-month lease is $187 a month and just $1,687 due at signing. Not driving a Lincoln Mercury now? Demmer Lincoln Mercury is enticing you over with the offer to make up to two of your current lease payments, all to slide you into a new Lincoln Mercury lease. Just call 313-274-8800 for details or visit Demmer.com. Demmer Lincoln Mercury, Michigan Avenue, west of the Southfield Freeway. For savings like these, totally worth it.
When I do it, I feel the blood rushing through me. My muscles tighten, and I keep going back for more.
Carmen Castillo is under the influence of Dana, her volunteer trainer.
Come on, Carmen, again.
By spending one day a week in the gym,
tuck your chin, Carmen.
Dana helps neighborhood kids like Carmen develop interests that keep them away from the drugs.
Hey, let me see your shoulder shift. Jab, jab, great.
Be a coach, a mentor, a volunteer. No matter what it is, you have something to offer.
Cool workout, Carmen. See you next week.
Log on to helpyourcommunity.org or call 877-KIDS-313 and be an influence on the kids in your community. Brought to you by the Office of National Drug Control Policy and the Ad Council.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. So we've been talking about the elections. What in the hell are they doing? Focusing on the wives of the candidates. Who cares? I mean, it's just all a ruse to get us to watch. Turn it off.
Well, now they'll all be showing up on Saturday Night Live. Oh, you know, it's just going to get worse, Peter.
And also, the proof is here. The whole reason the United States went into Iraq is just what we've always said. It's all about the price of oil, blood for oil. Four Western oil companies, ExxonMobil, Shell, Total, what's this called? Total. Total and BP are going back into Iraq after being out of there for 36 years. So
I wonder how many people are aware of all of that even. I just think there's so much surface level knowledge about what's going on there still after all this time.
All right, let's go to Todd in Southgate. Todd, hi, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Peter, I disagree with you on about, I'd say 110% of everything you say.
Whoa. That's pretty strong there, Todd.
Well, Todd, I got to say, you know, we once were in a minority in terms of opinion in this country, and now that we're part of the overwhelming majority, we have great sympathy for someone who is so isolated.
Peter, it's still a conservative country. Anyway, what I wanted to say.
You're nuts. You go look at some polls. Every single poll, not political and not who, you know, that Obama now has a 15% lead over McSame, but everything. The majority of people want the national health program. The majority of people want to get out of Iraq. The majority of people want taxes on the rich. The majority of people want, and on and on and on and on.
I'll tell you what, you're complaining about oil prices so much, and if you look at Barack Hussein Obama's plan here is to...
That is so racist.
Well, it's not even, you know, it's racist, stupid, but even worse. It is a diversion from a debate about policy.
Because the guy's a Christian. Why do you have to, you know, throw that in there to equate him with Saddam Hussein?
Because that's his middle name. That's why. Yeah. And because you probably spend most of your time listening to these right-wing talk show hosts who are determined that this election will not be debated in terms of policy, but will scare the hell out of people by somehow associating this 100% American whose ancestors on the African side have been over here Oh, no, it's not true. Actually, his father was a Kenyan, so he's not... All right, that doesn't go there.
His father, who didn't even raise him. Yeah, he was completely raised by white people, if that makes any difference to you.
And had a white mother, so in any kind of sensible system, he would be white, right? We always say, mm-hmm. Mama baby, papa maybe, right? So, I'm sorry, go ahead. What?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, his plan on oil here is to tax the crap out of the oil companies.
Good, do it.
Tax them.
And the rich.
How do you figure that's going to lower the prices?
Well, it's not going to lower the prices, but what it could do, the oil companies, because in many cases, the Democrats have been in on this too, but it's obviously mostly the Republicans, particularly in these last eight disastrous years, that it's a matter of how do you feed the Treasury? And is it going to come out of you and me like it is now, or is it going to be coming out of people that are making obscene profits based on gouging?
Peter, if you look back in history, you will see every single time that taxes have been lowered on this country that the government actually makes more money because people...
It's like, what do you do? Listen to these right-wing talk show hosts and just come on here and repeat every piece of nonsense you ever hear there?
Prove me wrong. Is that not true?
Listen, it's not true. And one of the things that's happened is that the divergence in wealth between the ultra-rich and the middle class and the poor has grown now that Bush has given this enormous taxes to his buddies. I mean, you live in Southgate, man. You live in a working-class suburb. What the hell are you defending the rich for? I mean, the rich depend on people like you.
The rich also give us the jobs, Peter.
And then the rich also take it away.
I've heard that one so many times.
You're a tool. You're an absolute tool.
Oh, that makes you worse, dude. Sorry.
What did he say? I missed that.
I think it's probably best that we missed that. You should just move on, Todd.
You're a tool. All right, you're out of here, too.
Poor Todd.
Yeah, I mean, really, because if you think about it, the people that control things, the people at the command center of this society represent, if you really go into the ultra-rich, like 1%. Mm-hmm. So they can't run much on they can't get a movement. They only got 1% of the people.
Well, and I thought it was amazing. Another thing is that only, 2 or 3% of this country make over 200,000? Yeah. Only.
Yeah.
Only.
Yeah. Yeah. Most of us are pretty working class and pretty, you know, sometimes we make enough money to call ourselves middle class, but 80% of us work for someone. And it's the rich give us the jobs. Thank you, sir. And so, you know, what do they call those hats? Those kind of, crushed hats.
That newsboy.
Yeah,
hat.
Yeah. Yeah. And you hold it with both hands, say, thank you, sir, for my job.
It's like, may I have another? It's Oliver.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Here's Joe in Mount Clemens. Joe, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling. Hey, Joe.
I had to turn you on speaker. Hello.
Hey. What's up?
Hey, I had you on speaker, and I guess I was watching a thing on CNN because I had no choice when I go. Anyways, they had this thing on there about ICE, and they're about a company that buys oil prices, and they're the one that's taking all these oil prices by buying out of the country. They're buying all this that they're there. That was all. So they were messing with the oil prices by buying a bunch of oil and not using it. You know what I mean? They're buying it, kicking the place up.
And hoarding it?
Profits off of it.
And hoarding it. Well, let me tell you two things. I'm not, I don't know much about that. And two, the connection is so terrible. You agree, Jolene?
Well, it was tough to understand. I was struggling.
Tough to understand. So we may have to let you go. And our apologies, Joe.
We'll look into it.
We'll definitely look into it. Here's Dennis in Dexter, Michigan. Hi, Dennis. Peter and
hey,
Jolene.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing good.
I listened to you guys a few times, and I've really liked the show for a long time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
I was calling because, I don't know, I'd never actually called into a radio before, but,
Welcome!
I was listening to, the guy earlier about worrying about McCain's policies and stuff like that, and being kind of afraid to vote for him. Because
oh, for Obama, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, Obama's policies and stuff. And, I don't understand why you would do that because, based on our current presidency and stuff like that, I would vote for the better candidate every time.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I just see McCain as giving us the same crap for the next 4 years.
Well,
worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we have to be some big political analyst. He essentially says it, although, I mean, he simultaneously embraces Bush's policies at the same time he tries to back away from them. You're not going to see too many photographs, although I'm sure the Democrats are going to produce them from before, of the two of them embracing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if they're even going to have, they're going to have to bring Bush to the Republican convention, right?
So one would think.
Yeah, and so here you're going to have this spectacle of Bush coming on stage, and right now, only depending on what poll, either only 17 or as little as 14% of the people in this country think that the country's on the right track.
14%?
Yeah.
Whoa.
So you're going to see that 14% at the Republican convention.
Yeah.
And Bush will come in, and he'll get this standing ovation.
Oh,
you know, the balloons will go up. And all of this, and well, I don't know.
Painful.
Painful.
McCain has these TV ads on right now.
Yeah.
And he's talking about, you know, no one likes war.
Oh, yeah.
No, I don't like war. And then he goes through his whole history. My grandfather, my father, and I was shot down. Yeah, we know.
Yeah.
And so he's already on it.
On a military thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But he's trying to make other people, I don't know, feel dumb, in my opinion, you know?
They're counting on the American people being stupid.
That's what he's doing. He's targeting those people, and it just is so nauseating.
Yep. Ugh. All right, Dennis, thanks for being a first-time caller. We appreciate it. And because, again, it's not on issues, not on policy. I mean, if John McShane says that Barack Obama doesn't have the political experience to be the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, that's a political statement. Yeah, then it's up to Barack Obama to say, yes, I am, because blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Will at the many debates that will be.
By the way, that phrase, commander-in-chief, a couple of times that's gone by where people have said, well, Bush is our commander-in-chief. He is not the commander-in-chief of the civilians.
Right.
He is the commander-in-chief solely of the armed forces. So,
Don't let him convince you otherwise.
Right. Here's Gary in White Lake. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
Good. Good question. Hey, looking at the Republicans and Democrats, obviously you guys are Democrats, right?
No.
I didn't think the McShane guy.
Well, no. Let me say this.
We're not Republicans for sure, and we're not Democrats.
I'm for the lesser of two evils rather than the greater of the two evils. And so I voted like I held my nose and voted for John Kerry in 2004. As weak a candidate as he was, and as much as he tried to move to the center hopefully attracting the independents. But no, I would definitely not call myself a Democrat.
Moderates.
Yeah.
I will say, I mean, I'm a Democrat myself, but the whole McShane thing is a little bit of when you go overboard on the anti-Republican thing, just to give you a hint, it kind of turns people off a little bit.
Well, but don't speak for other people. It turns you off.
Well, you're right.
Well, you can't name me five other people that are turned off by it, right?
I have one, two. No, you're right. That, good point. But I'm just saying it may serve some justification if you don't go too hard on it. And I know what you're saying, but at the same time, it's just my little small words of wisdom.
No, I appreciate that, Gary. But here's what you do in talk radio. This isn't like a National Public Radio
I'm just going to be quiet.
Yeah, where you get these commentators going blah 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 blah. I mean, talk radio of the type I do and of these right wingers do and of stuff on Air America and Nova M Radio Network. It's supposed to be sort of pumped up with that.
Okay, I'm talking again.
Okay,
it's sometimes it's inflammatory.
Yeah.
To create conversation.
Yeah, which I intend. So,
but we mean what we say as well. We hold back sometimes, actually.
Those,
I know I do.
Those arguments, but I mean, you did hit it, Gary, because those arguments in the Latin phrase is ad hominem. In other words, you're attacking the man rather than what he's saying. But like the McSame means is shorthand from saying, so every time I say that, it's shorthand from saying that John McCain has the same policies as George W. Bush. And
that's not so crazy, is it?
You know what? Touche, because it's making me calm. So.
Yeah, but it's not so crazy to say that we can expect the same.
Yeah.
No, you know what? It's not. And the funny thing is, I agree with you. I just like, you know, I take the other guy's point of view, you know, the underdog. But my point, the reason I'm calling is a question about Barack. And
yeah.
I'm gonna really try and do this delicately. Like, I, Barack.
Is he colored?
No. Oh, no.
No.
Peter.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Colored.
Yeah. Yeah,
he's a little bit colored,
yeah.
And that, you know, that hasn't even crossed my, honestly,
I know.
God, has not even crossed my mind.
I'm
but
only kidding.
One thing, the closer it gets to the election, I'm wondering if Americans are going to be a little bit scared, or if that thing will come up, you know, the whole African-American thing will come up and at the very end, and people are going to say, oh, yeah, heck yeah. You know, the polls say, oh, yeah, I don't mind voting for an African-American, a black man. And then when it really comes down to it, if it really, you know, it gets close and they back off. I'm just wondering what you're
saying. Well, I think that's a good question. And here's what I think, and partly it's, I guess, based on my hope, that we've moved beyond that in the fact that there'll be people that are in the public eye from the people that we love and admire in sports and entertainment, people like Oprah, who else? The fact that Condoleezza Rice and I can't even think, the ex-Secretary of State, whose name was the guy that lied at the UN.
Oh, Colin Powell?
Colin Powell, yeah. That at least in terms of popular figures, popular in the sense of being presented to the public, that we're really beyond that. If we're not, we really should. But it's a concern. I guess I'm hopeful, particularly when Barack Obama, I mean, I think he's a pretty dynamic personality, even forgetting about policy.
Or color.
Well, I think that the what's the word?
Dynamic?
Dynamicism. Dinosaurs? I don't know. He's dynamic enough. He's dynamic enough that it's not going to matter. I hope too. All right. Thank you, Gary. I mean, the idea that a man could lose a political race because of his race, color, creed, national origin.
It already is an issue.
Yeah.
I don't think as we get closer it's going to become one. It already is an issue for some people.
But I think
let's just admit it.
But those people, yeah. But I think it's going to fade.
You know, what's so sad is I was downtown today and there was just the diversity of, you know, women in headscarves and black people and white people and Asian people. And there was the Little People Convention. And we were all down there together. Get, you know, in the name of music, and then I hear things like this, and I think, oh, my God, you know, where was I earlier today where we were all together having a great time, and then we have to still talk about this issue.
Well, Gary
was really pathetic.
Yeah, but he was asking.
Yeah, I'm not directing this toward the caller. I'm just saying in general.
I think he's like so many Democrats are, that he's fearful that racism will trump common sense.
Right, yeah. And you have every right to be fearful of that.
I agree.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
We're okay. We have more callers on the line.
Good. There you go. How come no other talk show in the world, the hosts cough? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
Yeah, what is it?
Maybe they have exercises before
Maybe it's the studio.
Maybe.
It is.
It's always cold in here. I know.
Here's
that.
Joe in Disgusta Township. What is what's the name of it, Joe?
It's Disgusta Township.
Okay.
We've talked about this before. There's kind of a racist vibe out here, which has led me to dub Augusta Township that.
Oh, Augusta. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Disgusta. Okay.
Right.
Right. Well, anyway, the first little tidbit I wanted to throw in was victory. We won. All right. Dick Cheney and all these other people, we're going to stay the course in Iraq until we achieve victory, whatever that means. We've got it. The oil companies, they're back in there after all this time. They've got their damn victory. The troops can come home now.
Oh, yes, yes. Hear, hear.
Yeah.
And the other thing in response to good old Todd was the use of Barack Obama's middle name.
Yeah.
I called this a week ago when Barack Obama and Al Gore were in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And they always do this thing think like Bill Clinton, right? And when they're heralding William Jefferson Clinton, you know, and they always put the middle name in there, and they're reluctant to do that. I noticed.
Well, with you know what
they
I think?
I don't want to say Hussein.
Maybe they, yeah, maybe
because
they,
it'll freak people out.
Maybe they ought to do it more and more and more and more. And
yeah, then it, make then it not such a shocker.
Yeah.
But I just, you know, I thought to myself, you just wait. You know, they're going to pick up on this just like I picked up on it. The right wing machine. You know, they're going to jump on this, and they're going to have
Todd
opinions talking about
it. Did it right here, yeah.
Yeah, no, you're talking in the future tense, Joe. Every right-wing show refers
They've
to...
They've already done it.
Yeah, they say Barack Hussein Obama. I've heard shows, I was saying the other week, I never listened to these right-wing shows, but I was listening to this guy go on for like 15 minutes about how he was tied into terrorist networks, both domestically and abroad, and it's
really filling people's heads full of these just complete flat out lies.
Yeah, but we shall see. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your call to 313-298-WRIF. And speaking of Obama, here's another caller wants to speak about the Democratic candidate. Maurice from Detroit, go ahead.
Hey, Peter, Julie, how y'all doing?
We're
Maurice,
doing good.
Maurice, what's up?
You know, I really believe Barack Obama is going to win the popular vote, but he's probably going to lose the Electoral College.
Just like in 2000, huh?
Exactly.
How come?
I think maybe, I'm trying to figure out how this really works in Electoral College. Do the delegates that they spread in half in Michigan and Miami have anything to do with Electoral College? That I don't really know.
Yeah. Maurice, how long have you had this phone?
Don't you know?
I know. You got to get a new phone.
No, I got to get another earpiece, man.
No.
Now you sound better.
Yeah. What happened? What'd
all
you
of
do?
A sudden, you sound better.
Anyway, this is what I want to know. Do the
Electoral College.
Yeah.
Do the Electoral College have anything to do with the people, how they split the delegation up in Michigan and Miami?
No.
That's one different thing.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what's going to wind up happening. He's going to lose the Electoral College vote. It's like 2000. It's going to be a repeat.
Well, I sure hope not. All right, Maurice, thanks for being our last caller this hour. Okay, we're going to take a break. Stay on the line if you're there. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And if you'd like to email us, been not too many open lines tonight. You might give it a try right now, though. Call talkyes@yahoo.com. I'll look at your email during the break and also tell you who's going to be on at 1 a.m. We'll be right back.
This is Night Call. On 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
My HD radio is just about the coolest thing I could put in my car. Now, why do I say just about the coolest thing when it's got all these new extra stations for free? Why do I say just about the coolest thing I could put in my car? Two words, my friend. Ejector seat.
If you're shopping for a BMW or simply a new car radio, ask for HD Radio. 100% free HD Radio at HDRadio.com. It's time to upgrade.
Attention high school students. If you haven't decided where you want to go to college yet, check out Oakland University's Macomb to Oakland program. Michigan's first concurrent degree program offered by Oakland University and Macomb Community College delivers all the benefits of earning an OU degree with the flexibility of taking classes at Macomb or Oakland or both, whatever suits your needs. At OU, you'll find a nationally ranked university that offers a wide variety of majors, great facilities, and the personal attention of a small campus. With the M2O program, you'll also benefit by easing the financial burden of college with coordinated advising, course planning, and financial aid. The M2O program can help students and their families ease the burden of college costs by helping students move toward completing their bachelor's degree more quickly. Find out if the M2O program is for you. Call 586-263-6242 or visit oakland.edu/M2O. Oakland University, your university in Macomb County.
The Landing Strip is back and under new management. Free prime Angus ribeye steak dinner. That's right. You'll be needing those $2 domestic or import beers or $3 drinks, including top shelf like Grey Goose, Jack Daniels, or Patron, to wash down thick.
She's my car. My car. I don't know how I lived without it.
Muscle car fanatics. Join the Riff Cyber Crew for free today at WRIF.com and get signed up for the Riff Muscle Car Club. Get special invitations for upcoming WRIF Muscle
Guy Club events. With a chance to win Best in Show, Best Banks, Best Engine, and Best Interior. One lucky Riff Muscle Car Club member will be front and center with a Riff at the 2009 Autorama. Sign up now with the Riff Cyber Crew at WRIF.com. It's totally free. The WRIF Muscle Car Club. Brought to you by Glendale Auto Supply. Shop a real auto parts store at 101. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. A couple of interviews I've done earlier this week. Daniel Pinchbeck, who wrote a book called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Whoa. That's
wow.
Easy for you to say. I don't even know how to describe this book. Sounds kind of new agey at first, which I'm not into at all. And Daniel Pinchbeck isn't either. But on December 21st, 2012, that in the Mayan calendar, you know, the Mayas from Mexico?
Yes.
It's big change is going to happen. So I said, wait a minute, that sounds totally new age just because something all lines up. What is it? I forget what it is now. Like the Earth will be at the center of the universe. The Mayans said this like 500 or 600 years ago. They figured this out. And scientists say, yeah, it is right at that time.
They were on to something. Oh, because they had all that time to sit and watch it.
Yeah,
discover. Right.
After that, Susan Quinn, who wrote a book called Furious Improvisation about this pretty much radical theater during the 1930s. And sometimes I think people go, wow, man, that sounds pretty boring. I wouldn't do it if it was boring. Yeah, so check
enjoy.
It out. Yeah. In fact, I'm reading the book. How many interviews?
Oh, I saw that at your house.
Yeah. How many interviews a year do I do? I figure about 90 at least.
Oh yeah.
Maybe 100 even.
A lot.
And so I don't read all the books, obviously, and that one I'm reading. So it's pretty interesting. All right. So let's go to Chris. Chris is in Harrison Township. Chris, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
How's it going, guys?
Going good.
Good.
Been listening to you guys for about a month and a half. Got turned on to you guys at work.
I just
have a question for you guys and a comment.
Sure.
Okay. My question is okay. I've been convicted guilty in the state of Michigan for smoking pot.
Yeah.
And I got felony charges. And when I was in court, they said I was not entitled to vote. Is that true?
I think in Michigan,
convicted felons cannot.
Yeah, it depends
state
by state, and I think most states that if you're you're felon, I actually don't know in Michigan, but very frequently.
I'm pretty sure that you can't, but.
Is that a bong I hear?
No, actually I'm walking right now.
Oh, okay.
It's the open road here.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I thought it was.
But my comment was about these gas prices. Is there anything that...
Which is why he's walking.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. I have a car, but I just can't afford to drive it. I'm still paying my car payment. But is there anything we can do? I mean, when we go to the polls or something?
It sort of depends. I mean, it's a big question. Is there anything we could do? Yeah, if we all of a sudden started bringing millions of people out in the street, started blocking traffic, if all the truckers went on strike.
Which they've been doing in little doses
the country. But if there was like a huge national general strike, I mean, that sounds so far-fetched, unfortunately, because they do in other countries. All of a sudden, they'd find some way to roll it back. Because right now, all we do is grumble. And it's told to us like it's bad weather, right? So
yeah.
it's bad, but there's nothing much we can do about it. And a lot of us feel, maybe even most of us feel, we're getting a little bit more screwed than we should be by the oil companies gouging us. But even if they weren't gouging us, it would still be high and whatever. So there's nothing much we can do. But the other thing, it's not just a matter of demanding low gasoline prices, although that would certainly be good, but diverting these hundreds of billions of dollars that go to, first in windfall profits that the oil companies have made, but also all the incredible tax breaks they get, all the breaks they get on acquiring public land. If that money was used to have a rush program to get alternative energy in here, a conservation program that would take a big chunk of how much we consume and all that, the prices would drop. But no one is committed to doing that in the political arena, and the people, us, have not mobilized in such a manner as to make it happen from the grassroots. We know that there's great changes that happen when the grassroots organizes, like the American Revolution and the ending slavery, women to vote. I always give this whole list of things, the unionization, the civil rights movement, stuff like that, is that that all of a sudden the people that are in power go, oh, I guess we got to change things because people are getting pissed off.
Well, it works in France.
Yeah.
I mean, they have, when I was in Paris, there was a transportation strike set to happen. I had to get on the train and get the hell out of there and go back to Amsterdam. Sorry. Love that place. Yeah. But
you wouldn't have had the same problem there.
Right.
Yeah. But, well, for instance, and that's another thing. In France, the legal work week is 35 hours, not 40 hours.
And they fought for that hard.
Yeah. And
in the streets.
And the right wing, which has the presidency or the prime minister or whatever, now said, well, we're going to cut it back to, we're going to bring it back to 40 hours. And all hell broke loose. And they go, oh, no, we made a mistake. We didn't say we were going to do that.
Yeah.
But I am not sure about Michigan and convicted felons voting.
I just don't know how you get a felony for smoking pot. I don't get that.
Yeah, well wait a minute. How did
you just kicked in my door? They were at a domestic violence in my apartment complex. And they just smelled me smoking weed. And I had 2 grams under a half ounce, and they wanted me to, I actually just got in my car and finally got to where I was going, but,
you know, I'm gonna let you handle that. All right. You seem distracted, but thank you for calling. And, so someone call us and tell us, in Michigan, if you're a convicted felon, do you get to vote?
I know it's that way in my home state of Iowa. Because my friend's a convicted felon. She cannot vote.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same crime?
It was a different substance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll happen.
Uh-huh.
Let's see. Here is Joe in Sterling Heights. Joe, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Thanks for having me.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I was just, I actually kind of wanted to make a comment.
Sure.
And, okay. I have not once heard of any other country that can hold a TV show based on really making fun of any political figure, let alone George W. Bush. If I'm talking about the show Little Bush on Comedy Central. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh,
have you?
I've seen it. Peter, it's a cartoon.
Oh, okay.
And it's Little Bush.
Yeah.
Tell them about it. It's hilarious.
It is. You know, and I have on demand. I watch that show every day with my brother, and we watch it over and over because it's still funny. And it's actually pretty accurate. You know, on every episode, he makes up a new word.
Like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know if I just, don't you think, well, okay, my question is, don't you think that they would have to pass some kind of copyright laws, you know, to kind of pass that on the air? And if they did, who would allow it?
Well, I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, what if they decided to do, like, a comedy series based on you, right, or on me?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, it's a parody.
Yeah.
So I think you can kind of do anything you want.
And it's a public figure, and it's not the kind of thing that that George Bush is going to sue them about, although early on...
He'll watch it, though, because he's so full of ego.
He actually sued some... There was some site that it was gwbush.com. Yeah. And it was an anti-Bush site, and he tried to get it suppressed and actually couldn't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, this was, you know, like right at the beginning of his term or something
long
like
time
that.
Ago.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks for
Thanks
that.
For
Nicolas Sarkozy is the president.
President,
of
yeah.
President of France, yeah. I don't know why I didn't know that.
I don't know. It was just, there's just so much going on.
There is.
Yeah.
There is indeed. Here's Jack and Romeo. Jack, hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to say to Todd out there, if you're listening, Todd.
Yeah.
I want to say a prayer for Todd tonight. You know, Todd, I'm going to get down on my knees because I believe in reincarnation.
What?
And I'm going to pray very hard that you come back as a diamond-studded jockstrap for George Bush. You can be real close to your buddy. Lauren Hardy in the White House will be leaving soon, and I can't wait.
Nice one.
All right, Jack.
Thank you.
As the bumper sticker says.
He's very creative.
Yes. Remember I said the bumper sticker last week, impeach Bush, torture Cheney.
Right.
People got that on their car. All right, we may have an answer here. Scotty in Roseville, do you have an answer on the felons voting in Michigan question?
Yes.
What?
What is it?
Go ahead.
Huh?
What's your you have something on the felony conviction?
Well, I'm a convicted felon.
Can
and
you
I'm
vote?
Able to register in Michigan.
Oh,
yes, I do vote.
Oh, okay.
Do they? Well, you know, I wonder how would they know you're a convicted felon?
How would they know?
Yeah.
Well, you just fill out a questionnaire, and you either answer it or you do not answer.
Oh, it's
it.
Well, I never had to do
yeah.
that.
Yeah, are you a convicted felon?
I'm confused.
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for your input on that, Scotty. All right. Here is Lars in Madison Heights. Lars Heights. Peter and Jolene, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter and Jolene. For once, I'm calling in with good news to report.
Good, Lars.
Okay. So far, the House of Representatives and the Senate have both passed Senator Jim Webb's new GI Bill,
that
which
is
would go back to a World War II style government program that would pay for tuition books and as well as giving a stipend for veterans to live on while they go to college.
Now that's more like it.
But John McShane is against that, isn't he?
Well, he and George Bush think it will hurt retention. McCain proposed an alternative bill that basically does almost nothing to improve the GI Bill, but allows veterans or active duty members of the military who serve for more than 12 years to transfer their benefits to their spouse or children.
Yeah, well, let's run over that a little again. They're afraid if they provide benefits that are too good for people that have risked their lives, who have sustained grievous injuries, that if the benefits are too good, they won't re-up. They'll decide, hey, maybe I should go to college rather than go fight in George Bush or John McShane's next war, right?
Yeah, this is something interesting. In the Marine Corps, about 70% of Marines do not re-enlist. And when you break it down to infantry, 86% don't re-enlist.
Wow.
Well, I can understand it. Although in April, the Marines got 142% of their quota. So these
did
were
they really?
Yeah, these are guys said, I'd like to
I
go.
I thought they were struggling, or maybe it was the
they
Army.
Were.
Or,
they were.
Oh.
They were.
So they did something.
Yeah. All right, Lars, thank you very much. Thanks for joining us on Night Call. And let me see. I'm just kind of trying to Google at the same time. We got to get you a computer. As old as co-host, but also as producer, you should be doing this, not?
Well, I mean, I have one at home. I just don't have one in front of me here.
That's right.
What you're saying.
That's right, yeah. Maine and one other state allows prisoners to vote from prison. But I guess, and I can't really make it, so someone's going to have to tell us about this. But I know in Florida they were, I think, going to allow ex-felons.
Yeah, I remember that.
The right to vote. All right, let's take another call here. Let's go to another state. It's Rick in Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I wanted to talk to you about the windfall profits tax.
Yeah, remind people what that is, Rick. Remind people what that is.
Basically, the American oil companies are earning too much money, and the Democrats want to tax them into, maybe a more reasonable profit.
Yeah, right.
I guess. Well, I guess the big problem I have with that tax is, isn't that giving advantages to the foreign-owned oil companies?
Huh.
We're going to tax the American-owned companies, but how can we tax foreign companies, foreign oil companies?
I don't know. I don't know what that, if they're doing business in the United States, Shell, for instance, whose home corporate home is in the Netherlands, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
And also, you know, with Exxon, let's suppose are we taxing them based on their profit margin? Exxon's profit margin, according to Google, is 9.32%.
Mm-hmm.
Companies like Google and Microsoft are closer to like 30% profit margins.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things the oil companies said, that in fact their projection of profits over this last quarter was less than they'd anticipated. It was a forgot how they exactly phrased it, but it was less of a percentage than, I don't know, I don't even want to try to mangle their rationalization. Well,
I wonder if it's the politicians trying to distract the issue from the weak American dollar.
Well, that's another part of it.
The American dollar is causing our global, oil's a global commodity.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots. It's not solely that we're being overcharged. There's a lot of reasons.
We've got higher demand in China and India. We've got less supply in the ground, even the peak oil theory.
Well, I think that there ought to be an excess profit tax across the board. Is that one of the ways that the maldistribution of the total wealth of this country comes about is through a taxation that allows the wealthy to pay so little compared to the kind of income that they have, to the point where so many make beyond even disposable income. In other words, what do you do once you make over $2 or $3 million a year? What the hell are you spending on? Nothing. It just winds up to be, money in the bank, essentially. All right, Rick, thanks for calling from Milwaukee, 313-298-WRIF. I'm trying to read this quickly, and I can't do it. Joe writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I just wanted to add that we can probably look forward to having John McSame's middle name more and the following quote from JFK on experience. To exclude from positions of trust and command all those below the age of 44 would have kept Jefferson from writing the Declaration of Independence, Washington from commanding the Continental Army, Madison from fathering the Constitution, Hamilton from serving as Secretary of the Treasury, Clay from being elected Speaker of the House, and Christopher Columbus from discovering America, which probably wouldn't have been a bad idea. And the latter.
Right.
Al Gore used it while here in Detroit. What, his Barack Obama's middle name?
No, he probably used that quote.
Oh, the quote.
Yeah.
That's right. He wouldn't have used his
name. I don't think so.
Duh.
That's what I'm here for.
I did see that. Wait a minute. Here is, let's see. I think this is Pam from the people that have one of those vigils done in Wyandotte
Saturday. Oh, yeah, peace vigil.
Yeah, peace vigil. Can someone convicted of a felony register and vote? Can a person confined to jail or prison register and vote? Oh, man, a person confined in jail who is otherwise a qualified elector prior to trial may, upon request, register, blah, 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 blah. Oh, after a Michigan resident who is serving a sentence in jail or prison is released, he or she is free to participate in elections without restriction.
Mm.
So in Michigan, if you're a convicted felon, according to this statute that Pam just sent us, you can vote.
So to that caller who called before, go register.
Yeah. Yeah. He was saying he was voting. Let's see.
Well, no, that the one before, the guy who was walking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can do it. Voting rights restoration process. So this happens here. Terry in Seattle tells us about Michigan. Automatically restored upon release from confinement, felon must register to vote.
Okay.
Maybe, Barack Obama's trying to get everyone registered. That's going to be, he's got so much money.
Yeah. Well, they were, I keep talking about it, but I was downtown at the River Days today, a big celebration of music down in downtown Detroit, and there were people walking around with clipboards getting people registered.
Wow.
Yeah.
Stephen Dearborn Heights writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. This week, Bush has threatened to veto a funding bill for Amtrak for the next 5 years, claiming the American taxpayers want Amtrak to be held more accountable on how they are spending taxpayer dollars.
Well, how about Bush becomes more accountable on how he's spending taxpayers' dollars? Give me a break.
All those.
How about public transit? How about mass transit?
Well, there's no money for it because all the money that is being wasted in Iraq and Afghanistan, and think about all the cost overruns, all the fact that billions are missing that they have no idea where it all went to with KBR and Halliburton and all that.
Yeah.
And Steve says this comes at a time when ridership on Amtrak is booming because of high gasoline prices. We all know the real reason why Bush wants to squash Amtrak. He and a few conservatives see public funding transportation as socialism.
Ooh.
Too bad Bush doesn't withhold funding of the Iraq war until the Pentagon and hundreds of war profiteering contractors are also held accountable on how they are spending the taxpayers' money.
Well, if they weren't his buddies, then maybe it would happen.
Yeah. It's all about the price of oil. All right. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mark and Warren. Mark, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for joining us on WRIF.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just had a comment. I think I'm a junior in high school. And I believe that a lot of Obama's popular votes are for the younger generation.
I think so. Yes.
Because I talk to a lot of my friends and such, and I believe that they're all behind Obama. Back before when Hillary was running, also, but
that's in their who they're supporting, right? They're not going to be 18 by the time the election rolls around, are they?
Yeah. Well, most of my friends will be.
Okay. Well, good.
Yep.
Well, good. Glad to hear it. Thank you for listening. And let young people make history again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah. Well, the old people messing it up as usual. let's see. Here we have talked about this a few times, but what the hell? Here's Ryan at Woodhaven. Ryan, hi. It's Peter and Jillian.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I am just calling to suggest a video for you guys to watch, or anybody for that matter.
Okay.
It's Zeitgeist on 2017 movie. It's online, free movie. And it is pretty much about government. They tackle religion as well, but it is a very, very informative movie. Or documentary, rather.
That's funny. Chris from Redford also wrote in, Zeitgeist movie opened my eyes. I don't fully support its contentions, but you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Go down the left side, and there's a headline from the New York Daily News. It says Bush knew. And if you click on there, you can go to all of the 9/11 stuff, just because I'm afraid that people will think I'm part of the cover-up. I'm that end of the conspiracy.
Please.
All right. Thanks for the suggestion, Ryan. Appreciate it.
I've never watched that. Actually,
I'm trying to think whether I watched that one all the way through. The one that was the big hit for a while was Loose Change.
Loose Change,
yeah. Which has some pretty cuckamamie stuff in it. Yeah. Here's Al from Inkster, but I think our question's been answered. Al, you're on the air.
Yeah, it has, except one minor point. It's no longer when you're released, you have to be off paper, too.
Oh. So you can't be on parole anymore.
Hey, man, yeah, parole, off, you can be on probation.
Off paper. You're employing what they call criminal argot.
Yeah, what are you
doing?
What's
up,
man? What's your story,
Al? Did you fall? Did you...
No, I was... I once administered justice, so to speak. I was a part-time probation officer.
Oh.
Part-time. That's weird.
Yeah, they had a program in City of Taylor. It was part you could do part-time or volunteer.
Volunteer?
Yeah.
You got to be really sick to volunteer for that.
What it did was, like, I was popped for drunk driving, and I helped a lot of people, quit drinking and,
At least quit driving when you drink.
Yeah.
I got popped for it, too, back in 1999, Al. Full disclosure.
Yeah.
And my probation officer was so burnt out, and I don't know if she's listening, but we're friends now.
Really?
Yeah, hey! I won't say her name, but she was so fried and burnt out from the system that when you said there's volunteers, I could understand when Peter said volunteer, what he meant.
Well, it's, I don't know. All right, Al, never mind.
Thanks. What? Yeah. Oh,
do you want to talk to him more?
Are you there?
Yeah. Do you guys want to go to the probation officer together or anything like
no,
that?
No, I'm done with those days.
All right. Good.
Thank you.
That's good. How long were you on probation?
6 months.
Yeah.
It was,
Did you have to get, like, tested?
No. Mine was very easy. I spent maybe $600. It was before, it was like, it was 0.10 then, before it changed to 0.08, the legal limit, and I was a little bit over. I'd been... working,
yeah.
Actually.
Well, we were talking...
But it was a bad move on my part.
We were talking right at the beginning of the show, so that's like an hour and 20 minutes ago, how last night you were at our house for a party celebrating the 50th anniversary of the peace song.
Yeah.
And this morning I was taking out all the wine bottles.
Wow.
There was a lot of them. So
yeah.
I would be willing to bet. Nobody got schnockered, right? Or whatever the word is.
I don't know. I was the first person to leave.
Yeah.
I had to get up and work today.
What was that song from Sly and the Family Stone? And they yell, all squares go home. So you left, right?
Well, yeah, you know, that girl needs her beauty sleep.
Yes. But in any event, I've been willing to bet that 75% of the people that left our party
were over
legally,
0.08.
Legally drunk. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And even I mean, I had two glasses of wine at your house.
Yeah.
I mean, I only live a few blocks from you, but that's still not an excuse to drive drunk. But I had been there for 4 hours, and so I felt I had no problem driving home at that point.
Okay. But I just saw the
usually one drink per hour.
They are even questioning that now, particularly with mixed drinks.
Question it.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you see the same thing I saw where how they pour heavy at clubs and restaurants? They pour heavy.
It's not like a single shot anymore.
No, yeah. It's like one, two, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you got to be careful. You've got to be very, very careful.
You do.
And for your life, for the lives of others. And
every time we talk about this, I say the same thing, that on a Saturday night, like last night, or actually, now it's Monday, so Saturday night, they estimate 20 to 25 million people drinking are impaired while driving.
It just scares the you-know-what out of me. And as it gets later, the more people are on the road.
But don't you think that, I don't know about you, but I don't ever get drunk. I don't even feel very high, but I'll bet you I could blow over 0.08.
Yeah. Oh, easily. Yeah. That's why I just don't drive, really. Yesterday was, I would have left my car if I decided to stick around and drink anymore and walked home because I live so close to you. Yeah.
You're right. All right. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Call talkyes at yahoo.com. A lot of good stuff, by the way, at my website, Peter Werbe, PeterWerbe.com. And let's go back to our phones, and we'll pick up Jeff. Jeff's in Sterling Heights. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, actually, the law pretty much from the 13 all the way down to...
Wait, we're going to do this, Jeff. We're gonna
you're
put
cutting
you,
out.
We're going to put you back on hold because you're cutting out. You're going to have to...
find a better cell area.
Yeah.
Wait, he's not on hold yet.
Okay, I know. So we're going to put you on hold.
There you are.
Yeah, okay. And find somewhere to go where we can understand you, because you're breaking up there. Here's Carrie in Detroit. Hi, Carrie. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Hey, you guys were talking about what we could do about the gas prices.
Right.
One thing we can do, I saw a special on PBS, and they were talking about ethanol. And they said that corn is absolutely the worst thing to get ethanol from.
Sure.
It takes about a gallon and a quarter of gasoline to produce a gallon of ethanol.
Yeah. Well, so what should we use? How about hemp?
Sawgrass.
Oh, okay. All right.
Sawgrass.
Yeah.
Or there's a lady that was one of the big shots for Microsoft. She's developing a plant down in Georgia that uses wood chips and stuff left over from the logging industry down there.
Wow.
So there's a lot of other alternatives.
There are,
indeed. And we need to push our representatives and let them know, because, a lot of these people don't even know that.
I didn't
know
about
corn
sawgrass.
Is bad, and we're all paying through the wazoo for it, and it's going to affect our food prices even more now that that's all flooded.
Sure, and any biomass can be used for that. I mean, people tell you make it from hemp and what have you. I mean, some stuff works better than others, of course.
Yeah.
But, the ethanol is one of the biggest scams that's ever come down the pike. I mean, it winds up to be, when all is said and done, in terms of global warming and energy use and all that, it's either kind of a wash, so it's no different, or in some cases even worse. And it does, as you were indicating, driving up the price of food.
Yeah. Yeah. And something else that I'd like to find out about, and maybe you guys know or one of your listeners knows, they said that the speculators have been driving the cost up on a lot of our commodities.
Oh, yeah.
Well, one of the things they said was that there was a law in place that limited how much speculation could be done on commodities. Mm-hmm. Now, what I'd like to know is, when did that law change, and who the heck rifled that through Congress? You know, was it one of these Bush guys sticking it on the back of something else? You know, how did that get changed? And I wonder what the timing is, because I wouldn't be surprised to find out the timing goes right back to when all the prices started skyrocketing through the roof.
Sure. Well, those are the questions that one of the men and one of the people, one of the broadcasters I admire the most in this country is Tom Hartman, mm-hmm. who broadcasts on Air America, and he's the guy. You know, he wouldn't, as soon as you asked that, I thought, oh, that's a good question. I hope somebody calls in to 313-298-WRIF. Tom would just go bam, 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 bam.
It's true.
He'd have it. All right, good question. Maybe we should call Tom. All right, thanks a lot. What time is he? Oh, he's in Oregon, isn't he? So.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, wait. No, it's 9 o'clock there, isn't it? 9:30 there.
Oh, it's earlier. Right.
Yeah, but he goes to bed.
He does like the show five days a week.
Yeah, yeah. And he does it very, very early. Yeah. Here's Leo and Troy. Hi, Leo. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi there, Peter. What's happening, man?
We're just doing the show.
Okay. I believe we should all do it. I'm sure people will agree. As Metallica would say, let's go kill them all and get the oil. Get the land. Take them all out.
Take them all in Iraq? What, like Metallica says? Are you joking?
Listen, like Metallica says, kill them all.
Are you joking?
No, I'm for real. They're killing our people, aren't they?
Well,
no, they aren't killing our people. No, they are not.
George Bush is killing our people. How old are you, by the way?
Oh, man, brother.
What?
Same age as Scott.
What?
Screaming Scott. Our overnight DJ here at WRIF.
I mean, they might still take you, Scott.
You're not old, by the way.
Yeah, you could go over and give it a hand yourself. But
yeah, sign up.
That's a pretty awful thing to advocate them.
I know.
And by the way, Leo, that's what we're doing. You know, we have killed hundreds of thousands of them, destroyed their country, created millions and millions of refugees. You know, they say the security situation is improving. I've said this maybe before, that I'm one of the few people on the left that said that I'm not completely convinced the United States is going to, quote, lose the war, that if you are willing to expend enough of the U.S. fortune, which is going to wind up to be over $2 trillion, which is going to just screw everything up from the economy in general to all the things we'd like to have in our country specifically, if we're willing to allow the deaths of thousands and thousands of U.S. soldiers, the wounding, the terrible wounding, the psychological wounding of maybe another 100,000 Americans, if we're willing to kill somewhere between a couple hundred thousand and a million Iraqis, drive millions of more into internal and external exile, well, we will, quote, win. And what's the win? As one of our callers says, the oil companies, the American and international oil companies, have accomplished, courtesy of George W. Bush, what the war was all about, to get their companies back in to exploit the Iraqi oil. So
your wishes come true, is what we're trying to say.
So we're killing them all, and God can sort them out, I guess. Here's Steve in Westland. Steve, it's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene. Thank you so much for having me. I think I have some answers. You've had a couple people ask about the speculation on oil.
Right.
In 2000, in a lame duck session of Congress, and this is on the Internet, if you Google Enron loophole, Enron had the law rewritten so that the commodities oversight, the regulatory body that protects the U.S. farmer from these lowlifes getting a hold of them and running them ragged, they took energy. They just removed the word energy from the bill.
Uh-huh.
And this allowed what happened with Enron in California. Notice there's been no more blackouts since they went out of business.
Sure.
They also did the same exact thing with propane in 2005. And overnight, after the company that supplied propane went out of business, the price of propane went from $8.50 a foot, they measure it by feet, to $4.50 overnight. And this is what's being done. The Regulatory Commission has no power to stop these people because the word energy was taken out of this act that regards the oversight of the of these people.
Yeah, that's what, you know, I don't understand all these conservatives. You have to say, you know, you have to just allow the market to do it. As long as you have the political state, which is the most dangerous institution ever created by human beings, and capitalism, which is the most ruthless and exploitative system ever created, it's an economic system. If you're going to have those, you have to have the most incredibly strict rules, regulations, restrictions, conditions on it. Because without it, you know, the governments just start doing
pillaging,
pillaging, raping and pillaging.
Yeah.
They do. I mean, think about it. Most governments, 98% of governments that have ever existed on the planet in the last 4,000 or 5,000 years have been absolutely horrible towards their people. A total 100% racket for the rich. I mean, that's why the political state arose. There was no real need for it, except that people wanted the people at the top wanted to defend their riches and their ability to rule people. So this institution, the political state, came into being. I mean, there never was a golden age of the political state or something. Then it kind of went down the drain. So after a few thousand years, we got things like the French Revolution, the American Revolution, the English Revolution. But even still, it's been a struggle every inch of the way to even make the restrictions on government and the guarantee of the rights of the people real. So we have to be very, very restrictive in the way both capitalism and the way the state functions. And when you get these conservatives saying, "Oh, we got to release all of the restrictions," you know, you're talking about people that are dangerous to our well-being. Al, listening in Rochester, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He's talking about the same thing: the Enron loophole for most commodity traders. For most commodity traders, must put down 50% of the price of the commodity. This was originally created to prevent another Great Depression. In 1999, that limit was reduced to only 5%. It came out of the Republican Congress and was signed by Bill Clinton. And he said, yes.
Another good Republican.
Yeah. He's, yes, originally I heard it from Tom Hartman.
That's funny.
All right, we got to take a break and back with our final segment. If you're on hold, we'll just be a minute or two and still time for you to call in. Remember, top of the hour, a couple of interesting interviews here on Night Call. I'm Peter Werbe. Jelaine Jordan is with me. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
At Motor City, we're more than earth-friendly. We're wallet-friendly. We're going green and giving away a brand new Ford Escape Hybrid. Just play your favorite slots or video poker to earn entries. You can win a new Ford Escape Hybrid plus $2,500 in cash. Or a FunJet travel package with $500 in cash. That's Going Green, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, June 16th through the 25th, only at Motor City Casino Hotel.
Detroit has its own unique tempo. Its own special rhythm. It's the beat of Detroit. And it's the heart and soul of the new Motor City Casino Hotel. Detroit's most electrifying new entertainment complex. The new Motor City Casino Hotel. The only casino hotel built to the beat of Detroit.
Take flight at the Landing Strip under new management. $2 beers and $3 drinks. Can you believe it? Wash down free ribeye steak dinners with $2 beers of your choice, import or domestic, or $3 drinks, including the good stuff like Jack Daniels or even Patron. Every day from 11 to close. All day and all night. Any beer is just $2, and any drink you want, Grey Goose, Jack Daniels, anything is just $3. Plus, all month long, the hottest showgirls flock to the Landing Strip from our 11 other clubs across the country. Any drink you want, whether it be Patron, Grey Goose, or whatever, is only $3. And coming soon, the free Las Vegas-style buffet. Full prime ribeye dinners free, plus $2 beers, import or domestic, and $3 drinks, including the good stuff, whenever our doors are open. Your nightlife is cleared for takeoff at the Landing Strip, just minutes west of Detroit Metro Airport.
Business is tough in Michigan right now, but there are companies who are bucking the trend. Meet Bill and Roseanne, owners of Glendale Auto Supply.
We've built our business on having a depth of inventory that is unsurpassed. And if we don't have the part you need, we can usually get it within 24 hours.
That's right, Bill. And our counter staff are ASC certified professionals. You're dealing with the best of the best in knowledge of auto parts.
We're proud of our staff. They're not just gearheads. They're professionals who love what they do. And now we've added two new locations in Lake Orion and Dearborn Heights to make it even easier for you to shop our stores. We believe in the Motor City.
So when you need a part, shop a real auto part store, Glendale Auto Supply. You'll come to know the service and selection we pride ourselves in.
Visit Glendale Auto Supply in Farmington, Livonia, Southfield, Walled Lake, Dearborn Heights, and Lake Orion. Or go to GlendaleAutoSupply.com. That's GlendaleAutoSupply.com.
Over 400 local shops count on Glendale Auto for their parts, and you can too.
Come see us today.
There's a lot to love here. A music scene that always seems to make, well, a scene. A sunny afternoon at the river. And soul food that fills more than just your belly. Sorry, got a little existential there. Yes, Detroit has a lot going for it. And now Detroit has another thing in its favor. 50 of them, actually. To welcome you to Bank of America, we're offering a $50 bonus with a new checking account with Keep the Change. So whenever you use your check card, we'll round up your purchases to the nearest dollar amount and transfer the difference from your checking to your savings. A $50 bonus. How do you like the sound of that, Detroit? Visit your local banking center today and sign up for a checking account with Keep the Change to get your $50 bonus.
Offer expires 7/27/08. New customers only. Keep the Change requires checking account, check card, and savings account. Interest-bearing checking accounts require a minimum opening balance of $50 and pays an annual percentage yield of 0.15%. Accounts must remain open and in good standing for at least 60 days. Ask for details. Keep the Change, patent pending, member FDIC.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much, Angeline Jordan. I welcome you back to our final segment this Sunday, 313-298-WRIF. This just in, remember the evangelist Ted Haggard?
Oh, yeah. He had one of those big mega churches, and he had... He was a boy toy. He had a boy toy while he was, quote-unquote, against homosexuality, gay marriage, all that. Yeah.
The evangelist, forced out of his job after being caught up in a sex scandal involving a male prostitute, has left a spiritual restoration program.
This is where he was going to make sure he was straight.
Yeah, and no longer has any ties to the megachurch he founded. Under a severance deal, Ted Haggard reached with the church in 2006. He agreed to leave the Colorado Springs, get out of town, and not talk about the scandal publicly. The deal expired at the end of 2007. Yada, 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 yada.
Hey, Ted, just be gay and be free. It's okay.
You can call him. Haggard answered the telephone at his Colorado Springs telephone number on Sunday.
Oh, my.
Confirmed he was in the city, but said he wouldn't talk to reporters.
Wonder if he's still married.
Yeah, let's see. After a former male prostitute alleged they'd had a cash-for-sex relationship. Well, that's what prostitutes do.
That's how that goes usually, right?
Yeah. And the man also said he saw Haggard use meth.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He stepped down. He was president of the National Association of Evangelicals, confessed to an undisclosed sexual immorality.
Oh, he did confess.
And he said he bought the meth, but didn't use it.
Okay, Bill Clinton. Whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, wouldn't you think it was weird? I mean, you know, well, never mind. I don't want to go there.
Oh, I know where you're going. Yeah. Just don't go there.
Yeah, all right. Okay. He moved to Phoenix with his family to begin what church leaders called a spiritual restoration program. And he was expected to include counseling and prayer. And it was supposed to last 5 years or longer.
Oh, my God. That's punishment. That's way punishment.
Yeah. He wanted to do more meth and see his boy talk.
You know what he could do is just, like, come out and just get a boyfriend.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's really not that difficult.
And he could go to California and get married.
There you go.
Yeah.
Again, yes.
I don't know why. I actually do know why. Seeing those, sometimes I watch television news to see how things are portrayed. And I saw the night, when was it, on Wednesday night or something?
Monday.
Yeah, but anyway, all these couples, including this lesbian couple that had been together for 55 years.
Yes. One lady was 86 and in a wheelchair. They were so cute.
And they were so happy.
They were so sweet.
And then you have these...
It's calling these poor old ladies, you know, sinners and things like that. I just don't get it. They were just beyond adorable.
No one, by the way, ever called us to tell us why or how anyone would be hurt by people of the same sex getting married. What was the deal?
Well, some people, I think, are all hopped up on things like insurance and things like that. But it's like, who cares? Can't everyone have, you know, what equality? What happened to the word equality?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what the American Revolution has been about. Started off pretty narrow, who got the constitutional guarantees and the freedoms, and it's been expanding.
Right. So let's keep on going in that direction.
Let's have the revo.
Come on.
Right. Ed from South Lyon. Hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, folks. that one caller, Scott, you know, he's the kind of guy that, you know, actually, he says those comments about kill them all, but then he goes to church tomorrow, and he thinks he's a good Christian.
Yeah, Leo.
actually, I'm calling, Peter, I got three questions for you real quick.
Wow. Three?
Three, I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
Yes, all, no, and maybe. What?
Okay, how can this country stop a bunch of terrorists, you know, from coming over here when they can't even stop the 5 million Mexicans from running across the border? Second of all, Peter, why don't you vote libertarian? And third, when they say the government is in debt, trillions of dollars in debt, who are they in debt to? And don't be scared to talk about the world bankers. Thanks, you guys. Have a great show.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff kind of embedded in there. I hope.
China?
I don't even want to suggest things, but World Bankers has a connotation that goes back into early 20th century Europe and the 30s and 40s. Yeah, I mean, we're in hock to banks that overseas. I mean, for some reason, I don't know why U.S. banks haven't loaned the government more, but a lot of it is Chinese banks, English banks, mm-hmm. French banks, what have you. Why don't I vote libertarian? It's because they stand for the opposite of what I just said. The political state, although to their benefit, their credit, I should say, and much in the platform of Ron Paul is that they're opposed to militarism as being the basis of the economy. They want to end the war immediately in Iraq. They want to withdraw the 700 or 800 bases, or some people would say there's even as many as 1,000 bases around the world. And a number of good things. On the other hand, they want to leave, in the economic sphere, they want to leave us to the tender mercy of the market, which means, as always, well, I'll tell you, good example, so I won't even have to go on and on about it, how the average person was treated by companies, in everything from wages to working conditions to health care and benefits and time off and all that in the 19th century. Because their deal was you work at least 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. You got nothing. You got no benefits whatsoever. And it was only through the organization of the unions. And here's what it's all about. It's about the selling price of labor. Because when we work, when I'm working now, when you go to work tomorrow, if you're working or your parents or whatever, or you, if you get a job and if you don't have one, you're selling your labor and it's a certain price. They could give you $10 an hour. They give you $100 an hour. And there's a conflict between the people that are buying the labor and the people, us, that are selling the labor, right? I mean, if you're buying stuff, you want to get it at the cheapest manner possible. And you know the whole thing about supply and demand. So if there's lots and lots of us willing to do the same job, the price gets bid down. And so the buyers of labor can get it at a much cheaper price. So what unions do is to artificially raise the selling price of labor. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Because you say, well, wait a minute. If it wasn't for a union, it would be like Mexico now. The Ford workers would be down there making $2 an hour, new hires making $2 an hour. Well, why don't we make $2 an hour in the United States for working at Ford? It's a couple of things. I mean, partly it's a tradition, but also it's a tradition that was created by the unions that bid up the price of labor and said, if you don't pay us a higher wage consistent with the profits you're making, we're going to withhold our labor. We're going to have a strike. We're going to have social chaos here. We're going to occupy your factories the way that workers did here in Flint, Michigan, for instance, then all across the country in the late 1930s. So, the companies decided, well, look, we're making so much, and these guys are really holding our feet to the fire, and so we will recognize that they'll get a price higher than we could. We'll pay them a price higher for their labor than they could get if we didn't have unions, but we can't have class warfare. Because normally class warfare, like now, it's practiced one way. They practice class warfare on us. They drive down our wages. They erode our working conditions. They destroy our benefits and on and on. We're not fighting back. It's a one-sided battle. The class war is being won by the owners right now. The libertarians, they no unions, right? Just the market. What else? What was? Oh,
there was
yeah.
Terrorism, and he talked about
the Mexicans.
Yeah.
Well, you'll be pleased to know that as our economy goes in the toilet, fewer and fewer Mexicans are coming across here. And I'll tell you what, if it wasn't, if companies like Ford and other companies that are that are operating in Mexico would agree to a continent-wide, that is, since there's NAFTA, rather than being so horrible for all of us, would actually do some good and have a minimum wage for Canada and the United States and Mexico. Guess what? All these farmers that are being driven off their land because of NAFTA policies and figuring, I got to feed my family, so I better go north, they would say, well, I'll go work in a Ford plant and make 15, 20 bucks an hour. So, but you know, libertarians would have none of this, of course. And, yeah. Okay.
Good job, Peter, answering all three. Yeah.
So, libertarians, they, in some ways, call themselves that only through a grave misunderstanding of the term. Here's Chad in Monroe. Chad, it's Peter and Jalene. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I would just like to congratulate you guys. I'm not one for talk show radio, but I was switching CDs and you guys caught my ear, so.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But I've been listening, and I am 18 years old, and I would just like to say that being completely up on politics is a full-time job, and I don't have time for that. But I would like to think that I have a good grasp, and lately I have been completely disgusted and confused because I've actually been looking it up and just, like, researching stuff and just looking at politics. And one thing that I would really, really like to focus on is we present so many problems in the government, but yet I sit at at my house and I watch TV in the afternoon and at night, and I see commercials and commercials and commercials just debasing candidates in the presidential race. And I sit there and I think about it. I'm like, how much money are they putting down on all of this propaganda? And how much stuff do they talk about that's wrong?
Tens of millions of dollars, of course. Well, I was going to say advice, not even advice, it's a suggestion. I wouldn't even bother to watch any of that. I always tell people in this manner, Chad, I'm in this business, and I've got to know as much as possible about all this. And I watch zero television. Once in a while, as I said, I'll watch the news because I want to see how things are presented. But I learned virtually nothing from the cables, nothing from network news, all those shows like Nightline and those Sunday morning deals
Meet the Press
and all that. I mean, Guy Arrest His Soul, Tim Russert.
I really loved him.
I didn't love him in the slightest. I thought he was a flack for power. You know, he didn't ask the questions, and he was just another one of those get-along guys.
Did you watch it a lot?
I mean,
I thought he asked some pretty good questions. As a journalist, I thought he was pretty good.
Okay.
Wow, Peter, look at us.
Read some of the stuff on my website, Werbe, peterwerbe.com, about Russert and some of the role he's played. But I would find some information, some sites. I mean, I got a lot of links on my site, and what you could do is compare those to, like, some right-wing sites. And then say, which of these makes more sense in terms of my experience, my values, the way I'd like to see the world, how I treat other people, and see which makes more sense.
Yeah, that's another thing. You look it up, and personally, in my mind, I think that the whole right-wing, left-wing, libertarian, Democrat, Republican, I really do not see the sense in it. I think it's a cop. I mean, I'm not trying to say that.
Well, you're a good anarchist then.
No, I'm not saying anarchy. I'm saying, in my opinion, if you really wanted to look up the sources and look up the real info and make your own decision on it, you shouldn't have to, get in a group and share opinion. If you wanted to have your own opinion and have your own, you know, like put in your own opinion and choose your own decisions, you should look it up, and you shouldn't have to say, I'm a Democrat, so you can associate with someone.
Well, I agree. I'm going to vote for the Democrat simply because he's not the Republican. But as I was saying earlier, I think the big changes in this country, and we need big changes now, aren't going to come about by voting. I mean, we need to get Barack Obama in there as a defense against the trajectory that these Republicans have sent us on. And to get John McCain in there would, as I've been calling him John McSame, would in fact create or continue the same policies. All right, I'm going to move along quickly. Thank you, Chad. I appreciate you taking the time.
Glad you found us.
Yeah, I'm glad you found us. And because I want to try to get as many people in before
the end of the show. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So we will cruise along here. And let's see, here's Ted in Ann Arbor. Hi, Ted, you're on the air.
How you doing, Peter? I just have a couple questions for you about the current state of what's going on in this country.
Sure.
You might be able to clear it up for me. I want to know why this country has such a strong alliance with Israel, and why are we sending them $60 billion in just a few years when we haven't sent the rest of the world that? Why are we keeping Israel under our wing? And isn't it true that kind of Israel controls this country by controlling the money and not controlling our military?
No, the latter isn't true, but there's a lot of reasons. Very kind of complex relationship. I mean, it began in many ways just out of sympathy after World War II for what had happened to the Jewish people in Europe. But ultimately, it is the United States Empire's strongest ally in that part of the world, and it can be counted on. For instance, perhaps to bomb the nuclear reactors or whatever they're producing in Iran without the United States having to do it directly, although I don't think Israel is going to do it either. There's also every candidate has to go and give his allegiance to Israel in order to maintain, they feel, I don't know whether it's true or not, it very well could be, Jewish donations to, there's always a big, American Jews are big contributors to the political party, particularly the Democratic Party. Republicans are always trying to erode that, get more of the money. And also, Jewish voters are very strong. go ahead, just finish my
sentence. Are you okay? Jewish voters are.
Thank you, my voice. I wasn't choking up.
I didn't
know
where you were going.
I wasn't choking up with emotion, I was just choking.
Yeah.
This damn cold still hasn't gone away. But Jewish voters are very important voting bloc in New York and Florida, California, New Jersey, mm-hmm. places like that. So it's in the same way that both Barack Obama and John McShane, and in fact this would be Obama McShane, will go down to Florida and say, yes, we're going to keep the embargo against Cuba because they want the Cuban American vote. All right, I hope that answered some of it, but don't buy into that Israel controls the United States, because that's certainly not true. But as long as Israel acts out U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, we'll keep financing them with U.S. dollars.
It's cozy.
It's cozy, but, well, it's a long discussion.
Longer than we have,
yes.
For sure. Yes,
here's John in Grosse Pointe. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Jolene, Peter, how are we doing?
Hi.
Hey, actually, I wanted to comment about a gentleman who had called earlier about alternative fuels, you know, the Georgia with the, the wood refuse and whatnot. And, you know, these are all fine ideas. There's another one about algae, you know, something about using a tenth of the area of, like, Colorado. And you can set up these farms of algae that actually produce petroleum.
Sure.
I don't know if it's necessarily crude oil, but it can be distilled into gasoline and whatnot. However, I think really the issue that we're running into is that this doesn't really solve the problem of, you know, say, carbon emissions and whatnot, if in fact one does buy into the idea of global warming and contributing to greenhouse gases and whatnot. We're pushing an issue under the rug when we know that there are other fuels out there, or not necessarily fuels, but other sources of power, such as nuclear energy to eventually, or that would in fact fuel a, you know, electric car or somewhat, maybe even a small fission reactor within a vehicle. Although that obviously.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we want to get away from nukes. You know what? All of a sudden, I just look at the clock on the wall. We are totally out of time. Thanks for being our last caller. My apologies for cutting you short. And I wanted to get to everybody. I got a number of people. Jeremy, James, Adam, my apologies.
You can always email if you want. If you, you want to let us know what's on your mind, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And you can always call back next week.
Yeah. And we'll be here. Hopefully you will join us. Stay tuned for our interviews on WRIF.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
I wanted to get in shape, but my gym raised its fees. I heard about hot deals at Motor City Steals and Deals, so I checked it out. I scored a gift certificate worth $100 for just 20 bucks. Motor City Steals and Deals says you half off or more at some of Metro Detroit's finest businesses. New offers are posted on Mondays.
Go to WRIF.com, click on Motor City Steals and Deals, and start saving. Get great deals from Good Eats Cafe and Grill, Annette's Hair Studio and Spa, Computer Design and Service, Marcy's Groom a Pet, and many, many more. Motor City Steals and Deals from the Riff.
Before I walked into Ace Diamond Jewelers while shopping for an engagement ring, I wasn't very well versed on diamonds. I thought the cut was something I did while shaving. Marquise was a sign of the theater. I thought pear was a fruit, and a teardrop was something you never wanted to give your girlfriend. I thought princess cut referred to the rich girl who didn't get on American Idol. Trillion meant three times smart, and diamond heart was actually two different things. I thought the salesperson was being forward when she asked about a girdle. A facet was a female basset hound, and I don't even want to say what I thought Asher was. Heck, I thought Jem was a truly outrageous cartoon from the 1980s. Before walking into Ace Diamonds, I thought Pavilion was a place to have a picnic, fire was something to roast marshmallows on, and a carrot was something to put in my salad. I thought a stone was something to skip in the water, clarity was getting my point across, and color had to be colorful. And I thought diamonds were out of my price range. But now I understand. Diamonds cost less in Dearborn.
Ace Diamond Jewelers at 13840 Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Ace, helping couples copulate since 1978.
Macomb County's biggest three-day festival is an American celebration like no other. 101 WRIF and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan present the 2008 Stars and Stripes Festival this Friday through Sunday in downtown Mount Clemens. And it's totally free to the public. Catch live performances from Candlebox, Johnny Lang, Sponge, Skid Row, and more on the Budweiser stage presented by Real Detroit Weekly. Plus, Metro Detroit's hottest logo bands on the rock stage, including the Dirty Americans, the Brian Schramm Band, and 60 Second Crush. There's a massive fireworks display Friday night after dark. The brand new Mobile One Teen Zone with BMX stunt show and skateboard exhibits. Plenty of great food all weekend long in the Royal Brian Ford Taste of America. Carnival rides, the Meyer Kids Zone, art displays, a salute to the military, and so much more. Get more info at StarsAndStripesFest.com. This Friday through Sunday in downtown Mount Clemens, the 2008 Stars and Stripes Festival, brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan and 101 WRIF.
Make a breakthrough statement without breaking the bank. Now only at Sarah Cadillac, lease a luxury edition Cadillac Escalade for just $458 a month for 24 months. Now hold on tight for more incredible savings from Sarah Cadillac.
Hurry to Sarah Cadillac on M53 at 30 Mile Road to get rebates of up to $6,000 and finance rates as low as 1.9%. Listen to this. You can get a 2-year lease on a Cadillac CTS Motor Trends Car of the Year for just $298 a month. Or save at Sarah on a Cadillac STS, only $417 a month. DTS just $367 a month. And the SRX crossover just $343 a month. No one sells Cadillacs for less, and no one works harder than Sarah Cadillac to make your car buying experience the best it can be. For more Sarah savings and payment details, call 1-888-GO-SARAH or visit drivesarah.com. Sarah Cadillac on M53 at 30 Mile Road, just east of Van Dyke. For Cadillac sales and service, we deliver satisfaction.
101 WRIF is your ultimate Tigers baseball ticket connection with your chance to win tickets to every home game your Detroit Tigers play in the month of July. Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Rim for your chance to instantly win a custom WRIF baseball t-shirt and a WRIF ultimate tailgater mug. One lucky Riff winner will score an incredible grand prize. You just might win tickets to every Detroit Tigers home game in the month of July. You won't just be the envy of your friends. You'll be the biggest Tigers baseball fan in the Motor City. The Riff ultimate ticket could be yours. Listen and win from 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. When whole countries or even the whole planet fall upon times that people see as troubling, they turn to a variety of different sources for solace. No longer are they taken up with the official versions of progress and security, and often turn to religion, turn to cults, turn to any number of ways in which to try to imagine a change that can get us out of a current predicament. Well, I don't know if that properly introduces my guest and his book and his subject, but it certainly has to do with an alteration of the world in which we live. My guest is Daniel Pinchbeck. His book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and that's going to involve some speaking to Mayan here, and we'll tell you about that in a second. And Daniel Pinchbeck has written for the New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Wired, The Village Voice, LA Weekly, Art Forum, and lots of other publications. He's the editorial director of the online Reality Sandwich. You can go to realitysandwich.com. We're reaching him at his office in New York City. Daniel Pinchbeck, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me.
Well, this takes so much explaining just right off the bat. 2012, that's only in 4 years, the return of Quetzalcoatl. Maybe you could give us a summary.
So 2012, well, more precisely December 21st, 2012, is the conclusion of the long count of the Mayan calendar. It's a cycle of around 5,125 years, and there's a lot of suggestion from what we can understand of the classical Mayan architecture and sculptures and so on, that they saw this as a massive shift, kind of transition in world ages or cycles of human development. I'd written a first book called Breaking Open the Head that was about shamanism and psychedelic substances, and I'd gone to different rituals and tribal cultures around the world, going through their ceremonies. So I went to West Africa, I did an initiation with a group called the Bwiti in Gabon, taking Iboga, which is a sacrament, psychedelic substance they use as their sacrament. I'd gone down to the Amazon and worked with a tribe called the Sequoia in Ecuador, working with ayahuasca, which is another medicine, a psychedelic drink. I visited the Mazatec Indians in Mexico, where they work with the mushroom psilocybin. And I had a number of experiences. I kind of started out this exploration as a journalist and a secular materialist. But I began to have all of these kind of psychic experiences that began to give me the sense that there was something beyond the normal material worldview, and that there, you know, was potential for telepathy, synchronicity, for all sorts of occult things could actually happen. So and did happen to me. So I had to rethink my worldview, and I realized that in a way our secular scientific materialism is kind of a belief system, and it seemed to me that these shamanic and indigenous cultures also had significant forms of knowledge and way of sort of understanding reality that we had totally dismissed and denied, but actually had validity. So when I went through that sort of initiatory process in writing my first book, Breaking Open the Head, I realized that we may have made a huge goof, and that we've treated indigenous traditions and knowledge systems as just like myth and superstition. We think we're the only ones who have like knowledge. But actually these other cultures may also have had a type of knowledge and even a type of science and kinds of technologies, but they were just oriented towards very different aspects of reality, kind of different aspects of being and experiencing, more related to the inner dimensions of consciousness. So then I realized that if we had negated their knowledge, you know, we had to look at it again, and they might, you know, because some of their understanding includes kind of a prophetic understanding of reality and also an understanding of how there are these kind of cycles of time that repeat and end and go in different phases. They might have an understanding of this period that we're in now that's important for us to understand. And then it turned out that if you look at the Hopi Indians, who were considered the first people in our continent in Arizona, or the classical Mayan civilization, or the Incas, a lot of different indigenous groups even around the world seem to share an understanding of this time as being this time of tremendous transformation. And the classical Mayan civilization did the most work. I mean, they kind of took the shamanic worldview and made it into the most elaborate civilizational form. This was a civilization that developed in the Yucatan from the 2nd century to the 9th century AD and created these incredibly complex architectural masterpieces and sculptural palaces with all these intricate plays of like light and sound and so on. And so, you know, part of their culture was really about understanding these cycles. They studied astronomical cycles incredibly precisely, and they saw this December 21st, 2012, as this alignment where the winter solstice sun rises the dark rift at the center of the Milky Way. And they saw this dark rift as the cosmic mother, and they also referred to it as a black hole. And our astronomers only realized in the last, like, 5 years or so that it actually is this enormous black hole at the center of the Milky Way. So for them, this was like this reunification. The sun is first father, the black hole is cosmic mother, and we're on this earth. And when there's this alignment takes place, we kind of reintegrate with the source, and then there's this transformation to another level of being.
Well, Daniel Pinchbeck, I think, given, of course, that listeners are only getting this impression, they wouldn't know that also that you're an extraordinarily astute analyst of political and economic developments in our country. And it sounds, it could be interpreted, wow, just sort of like the guy got high and suddenly he's into New Age stuff. Now, 2012, the return of Quetzalcoatl, is much, much deeper than that. So it's not New Age, is it? It's not, let me just ask it like that. It's not what we've come to call New Age.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to categorize myself like that. I mean, you know, the archetype of Quetzalcoatl is a Mesoamerican deity or god form or archetype, and I would see it. It's the feathered serpent or plumed serpent. So it's the integration of bird and snake. So we could see it as an archetype of integration of different principles, you know, of heaven and earth or spirit and matter, and maybe also these different forms of knowing, you know, the material and scientific knowledge system, and this kind of shamanic and mystical knowledge system. My hypothesis in the book is that these two forms of relating to reality are sort of coming together and integrating, and as they fully integrate, that is this next level in human consciousness and this next development. So for me, you know, I try to be equally skeptical, you know, about the precepts of materialism as I am about the precepts of kind of occultism and shamanism and spirituality, and really try to withhold belief, you know, and really take tentative steps to kind of move towards a hypothesis. And in the book, I say over and over again, look, this is just a thought experiment. This is what happened to me. This is my best attempt to make sense of these experiences and to create a kind of conceptual container to think about all these different subject matters. But yeah, I mean, I'm very into, you know, Herbert Marcuse, you know, Marx, Walter Benjamin, a lot of different types of philosophy and thought has informed the book.
Interestingly, none of who I think would be very happy with that other aspect of your analysis. So do you think? I mean, they were certainly hardcore materialists.
Well, actually, Walter Benjamin is not exactly. He was a kind of mystical Marxist, and he definitely saw this redemptive element. And I think you could look at Karl Marx as having had tremendous spiritual insights into kind of the nature of human existence. I think I could have had a good conversation with any of them. You know, even Marcuse.
Maybe it's his followers that never took up on it.
I mean, it's interesting. If you read Eros and Civilization, like Marcuse, you know, kind of hooked into the understanding that there was the sexuality, you know, and repression, the whole Freudian scheme, was at the basis of human culture. But actually, I think it's a kind of it's a lack in his analysis, that because he can't even understand in the 60s when sexuality began to be liberated, well, wouldn't that lead to some, you know, social transformation? You know, so he had to come up with this concept of repressive sublimation. You know, so my critique of that is actually, yes, sexuality is very important in human nature, and the control of sexuality, the suppression of sexuality, has a lot of negative ramifications throughout our culture. And I think repressive sublimation has validity as a concept, but I think underlying that, there's also a kind of spiritual impulse in the human being to have kind of initiatory experiences and explore other aspects and frameworks of consciousness. And really every, you know, culture, you know, pre-modern culture, you know, saw that as a very important and essential part of their, you know, reason for being. You know, so whether you go to the tribal cultures or the aboriginals, you know, there's always a set of initiatory practices and processes which sort of, you know, bring people into an awareness of these other levels of consciousness, cosmic levels and supersensible levels.
Daniel Pinchbeck is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. His latest book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. It's published by Tarcher. There'll be a link on my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Also at realitysandwich.com, there'll be that Daniel is the editorial director of. There's lots of information. Now, this, I mean, sort of what typifies the New Age thinking, which this certainly isn't what you're putting forth, is that they're just going to be for the, you know, this is just going to happen. We're going to have this worldwide consciousness transformation. But you see us, well, maybe in fact best I could quote that you gave in an interview with with the Fifth Estate magazine. Full disclosure, I've written for the publication for years. But you say, unless there's a massive ecological U-turn and a parallel transformation of human consciousness and human practices within the next few years, it is quite possible we will not continue on this planet. So this is not just to for the betterment or the advancement of human consciousness. You literally see this, Daniel Pinchbeck, as a matter of life and death. Am I correct?
I think we're being definitely, our species is definitely being presented with a choice here and an opportunity. And, you know, to take that opportunity in a positive sense requires our participatory engagement and our willingness to adapt and transform. I think Darwin said that, like, you know, the part of the species that survived, that evolved, was not the most intelligent or the strongest, but the one most adaptive to change. And we're at a point now where we have to become very, very adaptive to change. We're looking at a situation where 25% of species are going to be extinct in 30 years. 90% of the oceans are already fished out of large fish, like huge chains of ocean life are collapsing. Climate change is accelerating way past projections. You can look at books like with Fear and Violence, why scientists fear tipping points of climate systems. Basically, climate can, accelerate to the point where, we can have the melting of all the polar ice caps in the next 5 to 10 years, a rise of 8 degrees in temperature. We've unleashed a series of events on the planet, and some of those events are just going to have consequences that are going to be massive, potentially massive dislocations, refugee crises. We're already seeing, world hunger riots around the world this season, and now we're learning that, there are these massive deluges and droughts in a lot of agricultural regions for next season. It's a very scary time. And, the question is really whether humanity is going to kind of go into a kind of road warrior survivalist mentality, with the super rich, building their gated communities and hiring private security forces, or whether they're while the poor are basically left to die out there, or whether we can, shift into a really compassionate global culture and sort of get beyond the ego level, where we recognize that everybody on the planet is really the same consciousness, in different form, and that our aim as a species is kind of spiritual and soul evolution, and really providing materially for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I spoke recently at a Sierra Club meeting, and someone asked me, what did I think it would take for people to change their consciousness in a mass way along the lines that we've been talking about so far? And it just came right out of my head. I said, catastrophe. In other words, that people are so, in my estimation, so locked into the dominant models, paradigms of how to relate to our planet, of any evolutionary or mass change in the consciousness that you talk about in your book, 2012, and that's only in 3.5 years or so. Well, I mean, yeah, 4 years, I guess.
But then the whole point of the Mayan calendar seems to be that the time is not just linear; it's actually kind of cyclical and progressive. So we're experiencing this kind of exponential increase in the number of events, destructive events, but also creative events. New technologies, new tools. I also think there's a change happening in the nature of the psyche that among people who are kind of open to this area, there's a kind of expansion and intensification of consciousness that's taking place. So people are becoming more and more aware of synchronicities and sort of becoming more subtly connected to their intention and so on. So it seems like we're moving to some kind of crescendo, and it may be a kind of breakdown and then breakthrough, or maybe it will just be a breakdown. I'm holding out my hopes that it will be a kind of positive initiatory process. And if you look at that on the individual level, like a lot of people, like kids, will push themselves to the limit with, drugs and alcohol and speed racing. They'll want to touch the edge of their potential. And I think they're in a way trying to push themselves into kind of initiatory states of consciousness because we don't have a culture that really supports that in a healthy way. So I think in a way we're doing that on a planetary level. We're pushing ourselves into a kind of life and death initiatory crisis, where if we preserved initiatory practices, we wouldn't have to go through this.
Well, you mentioned Herbert Marcuse and his concept of eros before. Freud talked about thanatos, this drive towards death, and that's certainly manifest in so many aspects of the politics of the world, the economic system of the world, the way we approach the environment in which we live. And
But I would say the breakthrough in Marcuse's work in Eros and Civilization is that he sees thanatos as actually a kind of distorted misdirection of the life drive.
It is, but I think that billions are sucked into it. Well, you know, you talk about this dichotomy between the left and the right. But in this interview in the Fifth Estate that I mentioned earlier, you say the progressive left, ecological, and liberal intelligentsia are going to have to find a way to collaborate to overcome the individuation crisis that keeps us in our separate boxes. I mean, that it doesn't include the right. The right seems to be driving us off the cliff. Or am I creating part of what creates that separation?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I try to look at things, you know, that with this perspective, there really are no enemies. I mean, there's ignorance, but there's no real enemy. And I think you could, you know, look at a lot of things from this non-dualistic perspective. And, I mean, definitely there are people who are incredibly deluded and, you know, intoxicated, you know, addicted to their own power and control and ability to manipulate. And, you know, some of those people, you know, would really need to be kind of, you know, taken care of if we could come back into balance. I mean, I think it's interesting. I read somewhere that apparently, you know, in the human species, it's natural for like 1 out of 25, you know, I think mostly men, to have a sociopathic personality disorder, you know, where they really don't feel compassion for others. But because I would imagine in a tribal scenario, that kind of dispensation would be recognized. And those people would be, you know, they would have a certain role as hunters or warriors or shamans. You know, they would use that dispensation. But in our culture, I think that those sociopaths have risen, you know, in a lot of ways to the top of the totem poles, you know, because it's such a greed-based system. Where you're rewarded for inhumane, non-compassionate, detached decision making that doesn't relate to, you know, the human collective as a whole.
Mm-hmm. The left usually is thought of as completely materialist, much of it being based, but not exclusively, in Marxism. Certainly not anarchism, isn't it? But even you know, it has its heavy materialist strain as well. Yet I was interested that this last March you spoke at the Left Forum. I had appeared there the year before, but did you find that significant that you were invited, given that you have this dimension that usually is not identified with the left?
Well, I was happy to be. I mean, it was a little panel among many things. It was kind of the only nod to, you know, kind of consciousness. I did the panel with Teokasin Ghost Horse, who's a radio announcer in New York and a Lakota Indian, and you know, I thought he was really wonderful what he had to say. But I feel the only, you know, really the left, the kind of spiritual counterculture and the left progressive movement have to come together, and without that understanding that there's a dimension of consciousness in evolution, and that there are, you know, in these other levels of the psyche, you know, that you know, even science is kind of approaching through quantum physics or the work that, you know, the Dalai Lama has been doing with brain scientists and so on, you know, without incorporating that other dimension, it's a useless vision. You know, a purely materialistic vision is an absolutely meaningless one to me.
I was listening, a couple of weeks ago to this program on Air America Network, a liberal network called Clout, and they announced that you were going to be on their program the next day, and I thought, wow, that's all they ever talk about is Obama and how bad Bush is. Having Daniel Pinchbeck talking about 2012, the return of Quetzalcoatl, struck me as kind of odd. How were you received? Because that's exactly the kind of people that you'd be talking to.
I was speaking at a festival in California called Lightning in a Bottle, and I guess the host of the show was there and heard my talk, and he's been very focused on 9/11 and conspiracy theories, and actually the show was devoted to 9/11. He had a woman whose husband had died in the World Trade Towers, and somebody else who's part of the 9/11 truth movement. So it was a very odd context for me. I've kind of shied away from that kind of discussion. My perspective was that, you know, I don't know whether or not 9/11 was a conspiracy. But more important for me is what, you know, that we use our energies in perhaps the limited time that we have left before there are a lot of disasters and cataclysms, that we use our energy in the most productive way possible. And I'm not sure that, you know, this endless haranguing over, like, what happened to Building 7 or trying to get another investigation in the same corrupt, you know, legal system, I'm not sure that that's really a proper use of time and energy. It almost seems like our sort of psyches get stagnated when we turn around these issues. And that really, my inclination is that we use the limited time and energy that we have to begin to develop real alternatives and actually practice them. You know, like Rudolf Steiner said that, you know, you only can only oppose what's evil by building what's good. You know, and that really, I think, is how I see things. So, you know, at this point, like, I think that, you know, we should be training people to, you know, get off the grid, to grow their own food, you know, making alternative energy systems more affordable, you know, helping people rebuild communities, giving people techniques, you know, in nonviolence, like Gandhi taught, you know, that nonviolence in itself is a set of techniques that actually can be learned, like literacy can be learned, nonviolent communication, you know, skills in communicating that you know, are not aggressive and destructive to other people. You know, I think there's a lot of, you know, and then also using our time to rethink the media. You know, if we think about, like, the television, you know, media, you know, it's an entrainment tool that gets people to act in a certain way. So it's a tool for planetary transformation. It basically trains people to consume and gobble up the planet as their role models on TV and the commercials show them. You know, so obviously that's an unsustainable model. But that tool, that mass media technology could be used to move our culture, you know, towards sustainability in a rapid pace if it was put into different hands and a set of different values was promoted through it.
Well, in 1948, George Orwell wrote 1984, gave him about 36 years in which people began to use the title as a metaphor for repressive governments. Your book title, 2012, gives us about 4 years. Please don't take this in the wrong way, but I say this to elicit a response from you. Someone might say, well, it's like Y2K. You know, here's the prediction of catastrophe or transformation in this case, and all of a sudden it's going to be December 22nd, 2012, and it's going to be just the same as it was. What's your feeling towards, you know, as the day approaches?
Well, I mean, a few different reactions to that. One is that I'm not predicting, you know, particularly anything. You know, all I keep saying in my work is that, you know, I'm making a thought experiment. I'm trying to create the best hypothesis that I can, you know, having recognized that there's a huge amount of, content about consciousness and reality that has not been acknowledged in the mainstream culture. You know, I mean, for instance, the crop circles, this piece of 2012, and the fact, you know, I argue that I think that, you know, as a hypothesis, that those could be a communication from a galactic intelligence. I think there's some good material evidence that suggests there are. And actually, there's some very beautiful new ones. People can see at cropcircleconnector.com or other websites. Anyway, so I'm not trying to be predictive. I'm trying to make the best hypothesis I can. You know, I think that things are changing very rapidly, and there could be even a larger rapid transformation. I really like Peter Russell has an essay where he talks about how if we look at exponential revolutions in human culture, they seem to happen exponentially shorter in the linear time. You know, so there was the agricultural age, and that took thousands of years. Then the industrial age took hundreds of years. Then we've had the information or knowledge revolution or information age, and that's just taken tens of years. You know, and each of these revolutions is built on the past one. So you couldn't have the knowledge age, the information age, unless you had all the industrial tools, which got these devices out to everybody, you know, similar from the industrial to the agricultural age. So Russell says that maybe there's another revolution in human culture and consciousness about to dawn upon us. And he projects that as a shift from information to wisdom. You know, so at the moment we have all these incredible tools, but we're basically using them for very short-term and kind of meager goals. I mean, wisdom would be real kind of critical application of forethought foresight and kind of design science principles to all aspects of our existence. You know, so if industry happened in, you know, a couple hundred years, information happened in tens of years, we could have wisdom in, you know, 2 or 3 years. You know?
We can hope. Daniel Pinchbeck has been my guest. The book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Sting from the Police says, a dazzling kaleidoscopic journey through the quixotic, thank you, quixotic hinterlands of consciousness, crop circles, and ancient prophecies, as well as an intriguing and deeply personal odyssey of transformation. Daniel Pinchbeck, thank you. Yeah, go
Peter,
ahead.
You're also going to mention the Reality Sandwich?
Oh, yeah, realitysandwich.com. Excuse me, I always say that at the end. Realitysandwich.com. Daniel Pinchbeck is the editorial director. Lots of information there, including on Daniel's books, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, and Breaking Open the Head. Also, links at my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. Daniel Pinchbeck, thanks for being on the show.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Macomb County's biggest three-day festival is an American celebration like no other. 101 WRIF and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan present the 2008 Stars and Stripes Festival this Friday through Sunday in downtown Mount Clemens. And it's totally free to the public. Catch live performances from Candlebox, Johnny Lang, Sponge, Skid Row, and more on the Budweiser stage presented by Real Detroit Weekly. Plus, Metro Detroit's hottest local bands on the rock stage, including the Dirty Americans, the Brian Schramm Band, and 60-second Crush. There's a massive fireworks display Friday night after dark. The brand new Mobile One Teen Zone with BMX stunt show and skateboard exhibits. Plenty of great food all weekend long in the Royal Brian Ford Taste of America. Carnival rides, the Meyer Kids Zone, art displays, a salute to the military, and so much more. Get more info at starsandstripesfest.com. This Friday through Sunday in downtown Mount Clemens, the 2008 Stars and Stripes Festival. Brought to you by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan and 101 WRIF.
With election fever in the air, the good citizens of Metro Detroit are making their voices be heard. It's not about the left party or the right party. It's about partying up all summer long with Kid Rock and The Riff. Now, all summer long, 101 WRIF is hooking you up with the all-access pass to Kid Rock out at DTE July 19th, 20th, and 22nd. Here's what you do. Just pick up a WRIF Kid Rock for Summer campaign sign at upcoming Riff events. Display it proudly on your lawn or make your own sign. The bigger the better. The WRIF Kid Rock for Summer campaign team will be out and about scouring the Motor City for your sign. Display it prominently because you could win big. Keep listening to 101 The Riff for more details on how you could win big all summer long with Kid Rock and 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. That rocks. That rocks.
Hi, I'm Dr. Dan Moroff, the owner of the Cherry Hill Dental Center. I've built my practice on being a pioneer in the dental industry, and most importantly, offering all the latest and greatest services at a realistic and affordable price here in Metro Detroit. We offer everything from your best cleaning ever to a complete overhaul of your smile, and most importantly, your confidence. Being a one-office practice, I need to spend my limited advertising dollars carefully, which is why I partner with Brian and WRIF. After learning about my practice, Brian suggested I use my own voice so you could get to know the real me. Cherry Hill Dental Center's Get the Smile message, plus WRIF's responsive audience, have equaled great success for me and my staff.
Thanks, Dr. Dan. If you think your practice or business could benefit from an owner association campaign, give me a call at...
Allow me. Call Brian at 248-591-6832. That's 248-591-6832. Give Brian a call, and trust me, he'll call you back.
Greatly appreciated.
How about those playoff tickets?
Hi, this is Mike Kay, the health insurance giant. Whether you're single, a family, small business, self-employed, or on COBRA, Health Insurance Giant is dedicated to providing quality coverage at affordable prices. For several years now, I have been advertising on WRIF and have achieved incredible results. I always know when my commercials are running because I get immediate phone calls and traffic to my website, healthinsurancegiant.com. Calls from the Riff always turn into a quick turnaround meeting with the customer. Once we review their health insurance needs, most of these turn into satisfied, long-term relationships. From the entire staff to the phenomenal lineup of on-air personalities to my rep, Katie, the team at Riff is always readily available with fresh ideas for my commercials that keep the results coming. WRIF has had a strong impact on the growth of my business, and I'm looking forward to advertising on the RIF for many years to come.
Hi, I'm Katie Devereaux from WRIF Sales. RIF doesn't just rock, RIF works for your business. Call me today at 248-591-6836.
Shinedown returns. Shinedown with special guest Theory of a Dead Man and Blackstone Cherry, July 26th at the Fillmore Detroit. Tickets available right now at all Ticketmaster outlets. But keep your radio locked at 101 WRIF for the most free tickets for Shinedown, interviews with the band, and more.
Hey, what's up? This is Brent from Shinedown, and you're rocking with 101 WRIF.
How are you?
Hey, it's Mike. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you Monday morning with Cindy Margolis, who's on the cover of this month's Playboy on Stands Now. And, of course, she is featured prominently in the magazine. Ho-ho, is she nude? Also Monday, we'll talk with Stephanie Klein, who wrote Moose, a memoir of fat camp. She was huge since childhood and then lost all this weight after being called Moose. And her parents sent her to fat camp repeatedly, summer after summer, and she wrote a book about it. Plus, we've got an interview with Masioko, who's in Get Smart in theaters now, and of course everybody knows him as Hiro from the hot TV show Heroes. And remember our Mike in the Morning, the big fat gay wedding promotion we've got going underway, sending some lucky gay couple to San Diego to get married. Check WRIF.com/MIM for details, everything you need to do to enter the contest, all right? Meanwhile, we'll see you Monday morning on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Yeah, all right, I'll see you guys there.
Mike in the Morning, no subscription necessary on 101 WRIF. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you. Peter Werby here. Well, we are in, aren't we, a recession? Not in a depression. We know what that was. That was back in the 1930s. Hopefully, this right now isn't the good old days. But people responded to that Great Depression in many different ways, and certainly it's been chronicled many times in everything from histories to television programs and biographies, everything under the sun. There's an aspect of it that was very appealing to me that I first learned about in many ways, or at least in some detail, in the 1999 film called The Cradle Will Rock. Tim Robbins put it together. It was about the federal theater project, and it was part of the Works Progress Administration. If none of those phrases or those names of that I've just laid out there make any sense, they will just in a few minutes, because it's a pleasure to welcome Susan Quinn. Susan Quinn has written Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. And Susan Quinn is the author of an award-winning biography of Marie Curie. She's lectured on her life all over the world. And also Karen Horney, as well as a book, Human Trials, the Inside Story of Developing a Drug for a Challenging Disease. We're reaching her in her home in Brookline, Massachusetts. Susan Quinn, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this is kind of without any background whatsoever, and I don't know if everyone has seen the 1995 Tim Robbins film, The Cradle Will Rock, but was that a pretty accurate portrayal of what went on during the Federal Theater Project?
It dealt with only one production of the Federal Theater Project, and there were several thousand. But I thought, at least, it was a very entertaining movie, and it was actually one of the reasons that I decided to do this book, because I thought there was more to tell. I think what The Cradle Will Rock, well, maybe I'd go back a minute and say, give some context for this. The WPA, which you mentioned, was the Works Progress Administration. At the time it was started by the Roosevelt administration, it was the largest government project in the history of the world, and it employed 8.5 million people. The idea was to employ them doing things that they were skilled at doing, and of course the WPA really built much of the infrastructure of our country, thousands of miles of roads and public buildings and bridges. But the interesting aspect of it, which I write about in my book, was that the WPA also funded the arts under a program called Federal One, and there were four arts programs. There was music, there was visual art, and there are still murals around from that, and there was writing, writers, and then finally there was the theater project. And in some ways, that's the one that we know the least about, and that's the nice thing about the Tim Robbins film, because it reminds us of this amazing theater project, which employed 12,000 people at its height, doing all kinds of theater, and including the Crayola Rock.
Now, 8.5 million people are employed by the Works Progress Administration. That's a lot of people. I say parenthetically, by the way, that some of those murals painted under the Works Progress Administration still can be seen in Michigan area post office.
Mm-hmm.
They were quite taken with the kind of murals that Diego Rivera did at the Detroit Institute of Arts, and many of them. Yeah. It was a time, as we all know, of great unemployment. So 8.5 million people. Did that actually cut into the total number of people that were unemployed during the 1930s?
It made a substantial difference, a huge difference. In 1929, after the crash, when the banks collapsed and things really went bad, you know, there were as many as 20,000 people a day being fired every day. And for the next 3 years after the crash, there were approximately 20,000 people fired every day, every workday for 3 years. In some places, the unemployment was 50%. I think in places like Detroit, it was as high as 50%, certainly, and in the country it was 25 to 30%. So this was, even though we're going through a recession, it's not anything like what people were going through in the early 30s. And then the argument was, among many, including the Hoover administration, that there was no place for the federal government in terms of trying to remedy the situation. And not until 1932, when Roosevelt came in, did these government programs start in a massive way and rescued the country perhaps from revolution. People were hungry. There were food riots in the cities. It was a very desperate time.
Well, Susan Quinn, it's interesting you say that he saved the country from revolution, because many conservatives, both then and today, say that his programs were socialistic, that he was consciously a communist, and they had all sorts of calumny added to his name. On the other hand, many people say that the kind of working class uprising that were going on, that typified by general strikes like in Minneapolis, presaged what happened in Europe.
Yes, very much. And, of course, this was a time when Mussolini was rising in Italy, Hitler was rising in Germany, so there was a possibility of dictatorship here. And, in fact, when Roosevelt was finally elected and he went back to Hyde Park to figure out what he was going to do, one of his colleagues said, if you succeed, you will be remembered as a great president. If you fail, you'll be remembered as perhaps the worst. And Roosevelt's response to that was, if I fail, I shall be the last president.
That's interesting. Well, the book is Furious Improvisation, How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. It's the story of the Federal Theater Project under the WPA. Why that title, Furious Improvisation?
It is taken from an article describing Harry Hopkins. Harry Hopkins was Roosevelt's right-hand man and the head of the WPA. And as soon as he was brought on, he began what was really a very desperate and furious improvisation to put people back to work and to put them back to work in all kinds of jobs, including theater. So that's where it comes from. There was a feeling that things had to happen quickly, and they did. But the Federal Theater Project could have been just kind of not a very imaginative project to put actors back to work. But instead, because of its whom they chose to lead it, this woman named Hallie Flanagan, it became a very interesting and innovative experiment in theater. And for 4 years, something like 12,000 actors were acting all over the United States in a lot of interesting plays, including a very sort of timely plays about the issues that people were faced with. There was something called The Living Newspaper, which was directly addressing, for instance, the crisis on the farms, the crisis in housing. There was one called One Third of a Nation, which was about the fact that one third of a nation was ill-housed. That was a Roosevelt phrase. Employing all these people in what was really new and innovative and also controversial theater.
Now, the director of the Federal Theater Project, as you mentioned, Hallie Flanagan, to some extent fits the pattern of the kind of biographies that you've done of Marie Curie and Karen Horney, both women who were innovative or pioneers as mm-hmm. women in the field that they operated in.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's interesting you should say that because I have decided that that seems to be what I'm attracted to, these strong and innovative women. And in fact, I started this book really as much more a biography of Hallie Flanagan. But as I thought about it, I thought more and more that I wanted to make it a much broader, have a broader reach and really be about the Federal Theater Project, even really more about the Depression through the lens of the Federal Theater Project. So Hallie Flanagan is definitely my main character and my, I would say, hero, mm-hmm. but although a flawed hero. But it's definitely, you're right, it is, it seems to be a part of a pattern.
Well, a good one indeed. But it is unusual that in a time where there was very little public participation of women in the kind of roles that Hallie Flanagan played in the Federal Theater Project, that she was selected. There was probably among the 12,000 people that took part in the project, there was probably, you know, 6,000 men that could have done it. Why Hallie Flanagan and who chose her?
Well, she was chosen. She was chosen by Harry Hopkins, and Harry Hopkins and Hallie Flanagan both came from Grinnell, Iowa, and knew each other from Grinnell. But it was a controversial choice because not only were there lots of men, but there were lots of New York professionals who would have been more obvious. Hallie Flanagan was the innovative, cutting-edge director at Vassar College, and a lot of people thought, oh, that's just arty sort of a theater, you know, and what are we going to do? It's not going to work for all of these unemployed pros. A lot of the unemployed actors had either been in vaudeville or had worked in on the road, but she turned out to be a great choice. There's an interesting Detroit connection with her, actually.
Mm-hmm.
She had an aunt who ran a settlement house in Detroit. It was called Melville House. I don't think it exists anymore. But it was a settlement house for workers at Ford's factory. And for the most part, they were from Eastern Europe. And Poles, Hungarians, Macedonians, they came to Detroit to work at Ford's. And they learned English at the settlement house. And before Harry Hopkins chose Hallie Flanagan, she wrote him a letter, which I found, which I thought was very interesting. And in this letter, she told him that at Melville House, it got, during the Depression after 1929, it got bleaker and more shabby, and the streets around the settlement house were full of unemployed men, growing increasingly bitter against the government. And she said she used to be terrified to hear the talk at night about anarchism and communism. And she said, now this is typical of Hallie Flanagan, she said, this is writing to Harry Hopkins, not that I blame the men. Watching the waste and terrible contrast between rich and poor, I often wondered why they didn't smash up Ford's factory and die splendidly. So anyway, since she goes on to say that then the WPA came along, and suddenly these men started to have jobs, and things started to change, and, you know, that the WPA was working thanks to Harry Hopkins. This was a letter she wrote before he hired her about Detroit.
So now why did it have such a reputation, or I guess the Works Progress Administration and the Roosevelt government itself has such a reputation among the right wing and the conservatives of being so anti-capitalist? It, as you've said several times, Susan Quinn, it may have in fact saved the system.
It may well have saved the system. Well, what happened in 1938, around 1938, was that there was a backlash, a conservative backlash. And it came a lot from the South and from the Southern Democrats, who really resented Roosevelt and resented Eleanor Roosevelt. And in my book, I developed the thesis that a great deal of the resentment from the South had to do with racism and had to do with the fact that the Roosevelt administration advocated some progressive racial policies, especially, of course, Eleanor Roosevelt. And I believe actually that what happened in 1939 was that one of these Southern Democrats, a man named Martin Dies, formed the House Un-American Activities Committee. And he was, by the way, a second-generation Texas politician. We know about those.
And we should say, by the way, that that the House Un-American Activities Committee, known by its acronym as HUAC, was charged with ferreting out communist and what they called other un-American activities,
right,
as the name says, in American life, but mostly went on witch hunts, almost, I'd say about 95% against the left.
Absolutely. This HUAC really set the pattern, you know, then later for McCarthyism, the whole method of finding these fairly unreliable witnesses who had some kind of axe to grind and who were willing to just slander people. And that's exactly what happened in the case of the Federal Theater Project. They focused on it because it was, even though the Federal Theater Project was a tiny part of the WPA, like a tenth of 1% maybe, it made a lot of noise for its size, very visible. But what I also feel is the Federal Theater Project was the most progressive in terms of race. It had these Negro units who did remarkable work, including one in Harlem that put on an all-black Macbeth directed by Orson Welles, which became a sensation. And there were these Negro theater units all over the country doing interesting work. And there were, in addition, some integrated productions with blacks and whites, which at the time was unheard of. And also the Federal Theater Project was one of the first to insist on integrated audiences everywhere.
Tell us a little, though. I'm sorry, finish your point.
Well, so my point then is that Martin Dies was a Texas segregationist, and many of the others who went after the Federal Theater were claimed to be shocked by the infiltration of communists in it, and there were some in New York, but in truth, when you really kind of scratch the surface and look at what they were objecting to, more than anything else, it was race mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what came up again and again in the hearings.
Yeah. In your book, Furious Improvisation, you quote composer Virgil Thompson as saying that the Federal Theater Project was, quote, up to its ears in commies. And mm-hmm. in the 1990 film, The Cradle Will Rock, Tim Robbins, there's the character of Bill Murray, mm-hmm. who begins to see all communists everywhere, and he's mm-hmm. thought of as a pretty unstable character and kind of, you know, gets his comeuppance in the end. Yet I thought that in many ways it was up to its ears in commies.
I think it was in New York. Of course, you have to understand the context. I mean, there was more interest in communism and in the Communist Party in the early 30s than at any other time in our history. And the reason was that the capitalist system looked like it was on the ropes, wasn't working. Russia and the Soviet Union were new and exciting, and the abuses hadn't started to become public at that time of, you know, the Stalin period hadn't come to light yet. There was a lot of excitement about the Soviet Union, about communism as the new answer, particularly among intellectuals and particularly in New York. What was unfair about it was that those communists were a small, highly visible and highly vocal part of the Federal Theater Project, but there were 12,000 actors doing all kinds of theater and exposing all kinds of people to theater for the first time, and it wasn't just propaganda.
Well, you know, we've mentioned, in fact, I began the show with talking about the Tim Robbins production of The Cradle Will Rock.
Yeah.
And if you look at the cast, it's absolutely astounding, the people that are in it. And
yeah.
Besides Bill Murray and Vanessa Redgrave and Susan Sarandon and John and Joan Cusack, Reuben Blades.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Jones, who plays Hallie Flanagan.
Oh, yeah. And
wonderful actress.
Hank Azaria playing Mark Blitzstein, who wrote Waiting for Lefty, which is what
mm-hmm.
that's the one that they're producing. I saw it maybe when it came out, so I haven't seen it in a while. But what that was also the charge, that they were always producing left-wing plays, which,
yeah.
you know, it's all right with me.
Yeah.
But you know, I could imagine how these, you know, conservative Southern segregationists could not like it so well.
Oh, absolutely. The Cradle Will Rock, what I do in my book that the movie can't do is I talk about the context of that production, when it happened. The year 1937, which was the year that The Cradle Will Rock was produced, there were more strikes in 1937 than in any other year in our history, because that was just when unions were really beginning to flex their muscles following the new Wagner Act, which really allowed unions to organize in a big, big way. So this was all happening right around the time that Cradle Will Rock was in rehearsal. And right when it was about to open, in May 26, 1937, there was serious violence at the Ford plant.
Out of the Rouge.
Famous
Rouge plant, yeah.
Exactly.
Ford.
And then...
Ford goons attacking Walter Reuther and other founders of the UAW.
Yes, yeah. And then on Memorial Day 1937, there was this famous incident called the Memorial Day Massacre, which occurred in Chicago when there was a police riot against demonstrators, and 10 demonstrators were killed.
Actually, I don't mean to correct you. I know you're trying to do shorthand, but I think it's important to say, actually, they were picnickers from the United Steelworkers who were just essentially massacred, shot in the back
It was a really shocking incident. It was essentially, and it became a very, very touchy incident for the Roosevelt administration, because even though it was very clear from the hearings afterwards that, in fact, the police were at fault, Roosevelt had a very strong relationship with the mayor of Chicago, who had been one of his most important backers, and was reluctant to take sides. And then here in the middle of this is Cradle Will Rock. And Cradle Will Rock is a musical about the new CIO rising up against the steel industry.
The Industrial Union, yeah. Yeah.
It's exactly about these issues, and of course it takes the side in a very effective sort of Brechtian way of the strikers.
Mm-hmm. Now I don't know why I said what I did, but I said the performance of Waiting for Lefty, when the whole thing is about the Cradle Will Rock.
Cradle Will Rock. Yeah.
But the Waiting for Lefty was another one of their plays that were controversial, right?
Yes. Now, well, Waiting for Lefties sometimes been called the birth cry of the 30s, and it was a really important play because it was a play about organizing, and it was one of those plays that got people so riled up, you know, that at the end everybody in the audience is standing up shouting, strike, strike. It was actually not a Federal Theater production, although they did actually, it originated with the Group Theater. But it's all around the same time and in the same atmosphere.
And famous people were in the Federal Theater project as well, like Orson Welles and others?
Yes. Many people got their start in the Federal Theater project. Orson Welles is the most obvious, and John Houseman. Sinclair Lewis wrote this book, It Can't Happen Here, which became a Federal Theater play, which was produced all over, and that is a very interesting and timely play about fascism coming to America.
Mm-hmm.
And then just a whole lot of actors. People like, well, Arthur Miller wrote for the Federal Theater Project. Richard Wright wrote for the Federal Theater Project. People like Burt Lancaster started out working in the circus. There's a long list of people who might not even have continued in theater had it not been for the Federal Theater Project.
Susan Glenn, we're almost out of time. I just want to make sure that we cover a couple of things. The book is Furious Improvisation, and it's about the Federal Theater Project of the 1930s. Who were the audiences for this? There's a tendency, as is so frequently done, and you have a much broader vision of the FTP in this, on New York. But who saw these plays? And were they all over the country? I mean, were they in rural areas and places?
They were all over the country. They were in small towns and large towns. They were on the West Coast. There were very active Federal Theater companies functioning all up and down the West Coast, Los Angeles, of course, and San Francisco, Seattle. But then in also Chicago was a major locus. And each had their own personality. For instance, in Chicago, there was an enormously popular all-black Mikado, which was done and which then wound up coming to New York. So it wasn't just New York at all. And the people seeing these things, first of all, the price was right. There were tickets were 25 to 50 cents, very cheap. So a lot of people who had never been to live theater before saw it. This one experiment they did called It Can't Happen Here, they opened that play in 26 theaters all around the country simultaneously, which was quite a feat. And of course, they were very different in the different places. There was one, for instance, in Florida that was done in Spanish.
Huh. What ended the FTP?
The House and American Activities Committee attack, which really brought attention to the radical elements, and there were, of course, radical elements of the Federal Theater Project. And then congressmen, particularly in the House, the Senate tried to save it right at the last minute, but the House was adamant. And as I said before, my feeling is the underlying alarm was about the high visibility of African Americans and the race mixing.
So they essentially defunded it. I mean,
absolutely. They just cut off the funds, and the WPA continued. It limped along until the war, but the Federal Theater Project died.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. Just one last question. My niece and probably 12,000 other people just like her is an aspiring actor in New York City and would love to have another Federal Theater Project. Does anyone ever resurrect the idea of doing something like that?
Hallie Flanagan dreamed for a long time afterwards of a federal theater, and she insisted federal, not national, because national would be one monolithic theater in Washington, D.C., which would not be, that would be kind of un-American, actually. She had the idea of four federal theaters in the large cities. And yes, off and on people have talked about it, but right now the funding we have for the arts is extremely small compared to what it was during these WPA years.
We are spending our money on other things, unfortunately.
Yes.
The book is Furious Improvisation, and actually that's the website for it, furiousimprovisation.com. It brings that whole period alive, centering on an incredible cast of characters that were part of the Federal Theater Project. The subtitle is How the WPA and a Cast of Thousands Made High Art Out of Desperate Times. It's published by Walker. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Susan Quinn, thanks for joining me on the broadcast.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
This is actor Angie Harmon working as a volunteer tutor. Here, she's teaching kids to spell habeas corpus. Here, prosecutable. Angie played a lawyer on TV.
To find out how you can volunteer in your community, go to usafreedomcorps.gov or call 1-877-USA-CORPS. When you help your neighbors, you help your nation. Make a difference. Volunteer. This public service message brought to you by USA Freedom Corps and the Ad Council.
101 WRIF is your ultimate Tigers baseball ticket connection with your chance to win tickets to every home game your Detroit Tigers play in the month of July. Just keep your radio locked on 101 The Riff for your chance to instantly win a custom WRIF baseball t-shirt and a WRIF ultimate tailgater mug. One lucky Riff winner will score an incredible grand prize. You just might win tickets to every Detroit Tigers home game in the month of July. You won't just be the envy of your friends, you'll be the biggest Tigers baseball fan in the Motor City. The Riff's ultimate ticket could be yours. Listen and win from 101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. I wasn't going to school because I was just making money stealing cars. And one day I was put into juvie for two stolen cars, robbery of a house, and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Well, I was 10 when I first got involved with drugs. I skipped school because, you know, nobody cared. I mean, I was on drugs, and my mom didn't really care because she was on drugs. She was never home.
When I first got pregnant, school was not important to me, so I dropped out. And now that I'm 15, I have two babies.
I was heading nowhere. I just thought the only way I can make something out of my life is that if I get an education. One day I was locked up. That's when I really realized that, I mean, it wasn't for me. Like, I was only in there 2 months, but to me that was enough. It'd be better for me to stay in school, just get my education.
I still need to go to school to make it for myself. Stay in school. Give yourself a chance.
I think I'm happier now. I know I'm happier now.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy?
For freedom.
Freedom of religion.
What America stands for.
Why do I serve in the U.S. Navy? For honor.
Everybody. And watch out for everybody.
Freedom to vote.
Democracy.
Freedom to go outside and play with my kids.
I joined the Navy to serve my country.
Every freedom that we have.
The right to raise our kids in peace.
My little brother.
My wife.
My kids.
Our children's children.
The United States Navy.
It's not for ourselves alone that we serve.
101 WRAF wants you to enjoy the summer of excess with the loudest show on earth. July 15th at DTE Energy Music Theater. One mind-blowing day in the Deep Crew Fest featuring the Motley Crew. Plus, Bucket Cherry. Also, Papa Roach, along with 6 a.m. and Trapped. What incredible evening of rock in the Motor City featuring the rock band Second Stage Experience. Tickets for Crew Fest on sale now. Get them at PulseNet.com, LiveNation.com, and all Ticketmaster outlets. Charge at 248-645-6666. Plus, keep your radio locked on 101 The Riff for your free tickets to Crew Fest, interviews with the band, and much more. July 15th, Crew Fest rocks. DTE for the Motor City's one and only concert Station 101
WRIF HD1 Detroit. I'm Taylor Robinson. Time to get the music on for you. Got Kid Rock up next, and don't forget he's going to be out at DTE on July 19th, 20th, and the 22nd. Also, you got to pick up your Kid Rock road signs at a Riff event, stick them in your lawn, and win big. Here's American Badass on the Riff.
Yeah, and I've set up and tore down this stage with my own few hands. We've traveled this land, packed tight in minivans, and all this for the fans, girls, money, and fame. I played their game, and had to scream my name. I will show no shame, I live and die for this. And if I come off soft, fix you on this.
Are you scared?
Devil without a cause, and I'm back with the Beaver hats and Ben Davis slacks. 30 pack of strolls, 30 pack of... No Rogaine in the propane.